This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents The Mortal Instruments, Book 6, City of Heavenly Fire, by Cassandra Clare. Read by Sophie Turner and Jason Doring.
These violent delights. Clary's own harsh breathing was loud in her ears. She thought of the first time that Luke had ever taken her swimming, in the lake at the farm, and how she had sunk so far down into the blue-green water that the world outside had disappeared, and there was only the sound of her own heartbeat, echoing and distorted. She had wondered if she had left the world behind, if she would always be lost, until Luke had reached down and pulled her back, sputtering and disoriented, into the sunlight. She felt that way now, as if she had tumbled into another world, distorted and suffocating and unreal. The room was the same worn furniture and wood walls and colorful rug, dimmed and bleached by the moonlight. But now Sebastian had sprung up in the middle of it, like some exotic poisonous flower, growing in a bed of familiar weeds. In what felt like slow motion, Clary turned to run back out through the open door, only to find it banging shut in her face. An invisible force seized hold of her, spinning her around and slamming her up against the bedroom wall, her head hitting the wood. She blinked away tears of pain and tried to move her legs. She couldn't. She was pinned against the wall, paralyzed from the waist down. "My apologies for the binding spell," Sebastian said, a light mocking tone to his voice. He lay back against the pillows, stretching his arms up to touch the headboard in a cat-like arch. His t-shirt had ridden up, bearing his flat, pale stomach, traced with the lines of runes. There was something that was clearly meant to be seductive about the pose, something that made nausea twist in her gut. "It took me a little while to set up, but you know how it is. One can't take risks." "Sebastian." To her amazement, her voice was steady. She was very aware of every inch of her skin. She felt exposed and vulnerable, as if she were standing without gear or protection in front of flying broken glass. "Why are you here?" His sharp face was thoughtful, searching. A serpent sleeping in the sun, just waking. Not dangerous quite yet. "Because I've missed you, little sister." "Have you missed me?" She thought about screaming, but Sebastian would have a dagger in her throat before she got a sound out. She tried to still the pounding of her heart. She had survived him before. She could do it again. "Last time I saw you, you had a crossbow in my back," she said. "So that would be a no." He traced a lazy pattern in the air with his fingers. "Liar." "So are you," she said. "You didn't come here because you miss me. You came because you want something. What is it?" He was suddenly on his feet, graceful, too fast for her to catch the movement. White, pale hair fell into his eyes. She remembered standing at the edge of the Seine with him, watching the light catch his hair, as fine and fair as the feathery stems of a dandelion clock. Wondering if Valentine had looked like that when he was young. "Maybe I want to broker a truce," he said. "The Clave isn't going to want to broker a truce with you."
"Really? After last night?"
He took a step toward her. The realization that she couldn't run surged back up inside her. She bit back a scream. "We are on two different sides. We have opposing armies.
Isn't that what you do? Broker a truce?"
"Either that, or fight till one of you loses enough people that you give up. But then, maybe I'm not interested in a truce with them. Maybe I'm only interested in a truce with you."
"Why?"
"You don't forgive. I know you. What I did, you wouldn't forgive it." He moved again, a sharp flicker, and suddenly he was pressed against her. His fingers wrapped around her left wrist, pinioning it over her head. "Which pot? Destroying my house? Our father's house? Betraying me and lying to me? Breaking my bond with Jace?" She could see the flicker of rage behind his eyes, feel his heart pounding. She wanted nothing more than to kick out at him, but her legs simply wouldn't move. Her voice shook. "Any of it." He was so close, she could feel it when his body relaxed. He was hard and lean and whippet thin, the sharp edges of him pressing into her. "I think you may have done me a favor. Maybe you even meant to do it." She could see herself in his uncanny eyes, the irises so dark they almost melded with the pupils. "I was too dependent on our father's legacy and protection. On Jace. I had to stand on my own. Sometimes you must lose everything to gain it again, and the regaining is the sweeter for the pain of loss." A lone eye united the Undarkened. A lone eye forged alliances. A lone eye took the institutes of Buenos Aires, of Bangkok, of Los Angeles. "Alone you murdered people and destroyed families," she said. "There was a guard stationed in front of this house. He was meant to be protecting me. What did you do to him?" "Reminded him he ought to be better at his job," Sebastian said. "Protecting my sister." He raised the hand that wasn't pinioning her wrist to the wall and touched a curl of her hair, rubbing the strands between his fingers. "Red," he said, his voice half drowsy. "Like sunset and blood and fire. Like the leading edge of a falling star, burning up when it touches the atmosphere. We are Morgensterns," he added, a dark ache in his voice. "The bright stars of morning, the children of Lucifer, the most beautiful of all God's angels. We are so much lovelier when we fall." He paused. "Look at me, Clary. Look at me." She looked at him reluctantly. His black eyes were focused on her with a sharp hunger. They contrasted starkly with his salt-white hair, his pale skin, the faint flush of pink along his cheekbones. The artist in Clary knew he was beautiful, the way panthers were beautiful, or bottles of shimmering poison, or the polished skeletons of the dead. Luke had told Clary once that her talent was to see the beauty and horror in ordinary things. Though Sebastian was far from ordinary, in him she could see both. Lucifer Morningstar was heaven's most beautiful angel, God's proudest creation. And then came the day when Lucifer refused to bow to mankind, to humans, because he knew they were lesser. And for that he was cast down into the pit with the angels who had taken his side. Belial, and Azazel, and Asmodeus, and Leviathan, and Lilith, my mother. She's not your mother. You're right. She's more than my mother. If she were my mother, I'd be a warlock. Instead, I was fed on her blood before I was born. I am something very different from a warlock. Something better. For she was an angel once, Lilith. What's your point? Demons are just angels who make poor life decisions? Greater demons are not so different from angels, he said. We are not so different, you and I. I've said it to you before. I remember, she said. You have a dark heart in you, Valentine's daughter. Don't you? He said. And his hand stroked down through her curls, to her shoulder, and slid finely to her chest, and rested just over her heart. Clary felt her pulse slam against her veins. She wanted to push him away, but forced her right arm to remain at her side. The fingers of her hand were against the edge of her jacket, and under her jacket was Heosphoros. Even if she couldn't kill him, maybe she could use the blade to put him down long enough for help to arrive. Maybe they could even trap him. Our mother cheated me, he said. She denied me and hated me. I was a child, and she hated me, as did our father. Valentine raised you. But all his love was for Jace, the troubled one, the rebellious one, the broken one. I did everything our father ever asked of me, and he hated me for it. And he hated you too. His eyes were glowing silver in the black. It's ironic, isn't it, Clarissa? We were Valentine's blood children, and he hated us. You, because you took our mother from him. And me, because I was exactly what he created me to be. Clary remembered Jace then, bloody and torn, standing with the Morgenstern blade in his hand on the banks of Lake Lynn, shouting at Valentine. Why did you take me? You didn't need a son. You had a son. And Valentine, his voice hoarse. It wasn't a son I needed. It was a soldier. I had thought Jonathan might be that soldier, but he had too much of the demon nature in him. He was too savage, too sudden, not subtle enough. I feared even then, when he was barely out of infancy, that he would never have the patience or the compassion to follow me, to lead the Clave in my footsteps. So I tried again with you. And with you, I had the opposite trouble. You were too gentle, too empathic. Understand this, my son. I loved you for those things. She heard Sebastian's breath, harsh in the quiet. You know, he said, that what I'm saying is the truth. But I don't know why it matters. Because we are alike. Sebastian's voice rose. Her flinch let her ease her fingers down another millimeter toward the hilt of Hiosphoros. You are mine, he added, controlling his voice with obvious effort. You have always been mine. When you were born, you were mine, my sister. Though you did not know me, there are bonds that nothing can erase, and that is why I am giving you a second chance. A chance at what? She moved her hand downward another half inch. I am going to win this, he said. You know. You are at the Burren, and the Citadel. You have seen the power of the Indarkened. You know what the Infernal Cup can do. If you turn your back on Alicante and come with me and pledge your loyalty, I will give you what I have given to no one else. Not ever, for I have saved it for you. Clary let her head fall back against the wall. Her stomach was twisting, her fingers just touching the hilt of the sword in her belt. Sebastian's eyes were fixed on her. You'll give me what? He smiled, then exhaling, as if the question were somehow a relief. He seemed to blaze for a moment with his own conviction. Looking at him was like watching a city burn. Mercy, he said. The dinner was surprisingly elegant. Magnus had dined with fairies only a few times before in his life, and the decor had always tended toward the naturalistic. Tree trunk tables, cutlery made of elaborately shaped branches, plates of nuts and berries. He had always been left with the feeling, afterward, that he would have enjoyed the whole business more if he had been a squirrel. Here in Idris, though, in the house provided to the fair folk, the table was set with white linens. Luke, Jocelyn, Raphael, Meliorn, and Magnus were eating from plates of polished mahogany. The decanters were crystal, and the cutlery, in deference to both Luke and the fairies present, was not made from silver or iron, but from delicate saplings. Fairy Knight stood guard, silent and motionless, at each of the exits to the room. Long white spears that gave off a dim illumination were by their sides, casting a soft glow across the room. The food wasn't bad, either. Magnus speared a piece of a really quite decent coq au vin and chewed thoughtfully. He didn't have much of an appetite, it was true. He was nervous, a state he loathed. Somewhere out there, past these walls and this required dinner party, was Alec. No more geographical space separated them. Of course, they hadn't been far from each other in New York, either, but the space that had separated them hadn't been made up of miles, but of Magnus's life experiences. It was strange, he thought. He'd always thought of himself as a brave person. It took courage to live an immortal life and not close off your heart and mind to any new experiences or new people, because that which was new was almost always temporary, and that which was temporary broke your heart. "Magnus," said Luke, waving a wooden fork almost under Magnus's nose. "Are you paying attention?" "What?" "Of course I am," Magnus said, taking a sip of his wine. "I agree, 100%.
"Really?" Jocelyn said dryly.
"You agree that the Downworlders should abandon the problem of Sebastian and his dark army and leave it to the Shadowhunters as a Shadowhunter issue?"
"I told you he was not paying attention," said Raphael, who had been served a blood fondue and appeared to be enjoying it immensely.
"Well, it is a Shadowhunter issue," Magnus began, and then he sighed, setting down his wine glass. The wine was quite strong. He was beginning to feel light-headed.
"Oh, all right, I wasn't listening. And no, of course I don't believe that."
"Shadowhunter lapdog," snapped Meliorn. His green eyes were narrowed. The fair folk and warlocks had always enjoyed a somewhat difficult relationship. Neither liked Shadowhunters much, which provided a common enemy, but the fair folk looked down upon warlocks for their willingness to perform magic for money. Meanwhile, the warlocks scorned the fair folk for their inability to lie, their hidebound customs, and their penchant for pettily annoying mundanes by curdling their milk and stealing their cows. "Is there any reason you wish to preserve amity with the Shadowhunters, besides the fact that one of them is your lover?" Luke coughed violently into his wine. Jocelyn patted him on the back. Raphael simply looked amused.
"Get with the times, Meliorn," said Magnus. "No one says lover anymore."
"Besides," added Luke, "they broke up." He scrubbed the back of his hand over his eyes and sighed. "And really, ought we to be gossiping right now? I don't see how anyone's personal relationships enter into this."
"Everything is about personal relationships," said Raphael, dipping something unpleasant-looking into his fondue.
"Why do you Shadowhunters have this problem?"
"Because Jonathan Morgenstern has sworn vengeance against you."
"Why has he sworn vengeance?"
"Because he hates his father and mother."
"I've no wish to offend you," he added, nodding toward Jocelyn. "But we all know it's true."
"No offense taken," said Jocelyn, though her tone was frigid.
"If it were not for me and Valentine, Sebastian would not exist, in any sense of the word. I take full responsibility for that."
Luke looked thunderous.
"It was Valentine who turned him into a monster," he said. "And yes, Valentine was a Shadowhunter. But it is not as if the Council is endorsing and supporting him, or his son. They are actively at war with Sebastian, and they want our help. All races, lycanthropes and vampires and warlocks, and yes, the fair folk, have the potential to do good or do evil. Part of the purpose of the Accords is to say that all of us who do good or hope to do it are united against those who do evil, regardless of bloodlines."
Magnus pointed his fork at Luke.
"That," he said, "was a beautiful speech."
He paused. He was definitely slurring his words. How had he gotten so drunk on so little wine? He was usually much more careful than that. He frowned.
"What kind of wine is this?" he asked.
Meliorn leaned back in his chair, crossing his arms. There was a glint in his eyes as he replied.
"Does the vintage not please you, warlock?"
Jocelyn set her glass down slowly.
"When fairies answer questions with questions," she said, "it's never a good sign."
"Jocelyn." Luke reached to put his hand on her wrist. He missed. He stared muzzily at his hand for a moment, before lowering it slowly to the table.
"What," he said, enunciating each word carefully, "have you done, Meliorn?" The fairy knight laughed. The sound was a musical blur in Magnus's ears. The warlock went to set his wine glass down, but realized he had already dropped it. The wine had run out across the table like blood. He glanced up and over at Raphael, but Raphael was face down on the table, still and unmoving. Magnus tried to shape his name through his numb lips, but no sound came. Somehow he managed to struggle to his feet. The room was swaying around him. He saw Luke sink back against his chair. Jocelyn rose to her feet, only to crumple to the ground, her steely rolling from her hand. Magnus lurched to the door, reached to open it. On the other side stood the Indarkened, dressed all in red gear. Their faces were blank, their arms and throats decorated with runes, but none Magnus was familiar with. These runes were not the runes of the angel. They spoke of dissonance, of the demonic realms, and dark, fell powers. Magnus turned away from them, and his legs gave out beneath him. He fell to his knees. Something white rose up before him. It was Meliorn, in his snowy armor, bending to one knee to look Magnus in the face. "Demon-fathered one," he said. "Did you really think we would ever ally with your kind?" Magnus heaved a breath. The world was darkening at the edges, like a photograph burning, curling in at the sides. "The fair folk don't lie," he said. "Child," said Meliorn, and there was almost sympathy in his voice. "Not to know, after all these years, that deception can hide in plain sight? Oh, but you are an innocent, after all." Magnus tried to raise his voice to protest that he was anything but innocent, but the words would not come. The darkness did, however, and drew him down and away. Clary's heart wrenched in her chest. She tried again to move her feet, to kick out, but her legs remained frozen in place. "You think I don't know what you mean by mercy," she whispered. "You'll use the infernal cup on me. You'll make me one of your Indarkened, like Amatis." "No," he said, a strange urgency in his tone. "I won't change you if you don't want it. I will forgive you, and Jace as well. You can be together." "Together with you," she said, letting just the edge of the irony of it touch her voice. But he didn't appear to register it. "Together with me. If you swear loyalty, if you promise it in the name of the angel, I will believe you. When all else changes, you alone I will preserve." She moved her hand down another inch, and now she was holding the hilt of Hios Foros. All she needed was to tighten her fist. "And if I don't?" His expression hardened. "If you refuse me now, I will turn everyone you love to Indarkened ones, and then turn you last, that you might be forced to watch them change, while you can still feel the pain of it." Clary swallowed against a dry throat. "That's your mercy. Mercy is a condition of your agreement." "I won't agree." His lowered lashes scattered light. His smile was a promise of terrible things. "What's the difference, Clarissa? You will fight for me regardless. Either you keep your freedom and stand with me, or you lose it and stand with me. Why not be with me?" "The angel," she said. "What was its name?" Taken aback, Sebastian hesitated for a moment before he replied. "The angel? The one whose wings you cut off and sent to the Institute," she said. "The one you killed." "I don't understand," he said. "What's the difference?" "No," she said slowly. "You don't understand. The things you've done are too terrible to ever be forgiven, and you don't even know they're terrible. And that's why not. That's why never, I will never forgive you. I will never love you. Never." She saw each word hit him like a slap. As he drew breath to reply, she swung the blade of Hios Foros out at him, up toward his heart. But he was faster, and the fact that her legs were pinned in place by magic shortened her reach. He whipped away. She reached out, trying to pull him toward her, but he yanked his arm away easily. She heard a rattle and realized, distantly, that she had pulled his silver bracelet free. It clattered to the ground. She slashed toward him again with her blade. He jerked back, and Heosphoros cut a clean slice across his shirt front. She saw his lip curl in pain and anger. He caught her by the arm and swung her hand up to slam it against the door, sending a jolt of numbness up to her shoulder. Her fingers went loose, and Heosphoros fell from her grasp. He glanced down at the fallen blade, then back up to her, breathing hard. Blood edged the fabric where she had cut his shirt, not enough for the wound to slow him down. Disappointment shot through her, more painful than the ache in her wrist. His body pinned hers to the door. She could feel the tension in every line of him. His voice was knife-like. "That blade is Heosphoros, the Dawnbringer. Where did you find it?" "In a weapon shop," she gasped. Feeling was coming back to her shoulder. The pain was intense. "The woman who owned the place gave it to me. She said nobody else would ever want a Morgenstern blade. Our blood is tainted. But it is our blood." He pounced on the words. "And you took the sword. You wanted it." She could feel the heat burning off him. It seemed to shimmer around him, like the flame of a dying star. He bent his head until his lips touched her neck, and spoke against her skin, his words matching the tempo of her pulse. She closed her eyes with a shudder as his hands ran up her body. "You lie when you tell me you'll never love me," he said. "That were different. You lie just like I do." "Stop," she said. "Get your hands off me." "But you're mine," he said. "I want you to. I need you to." He took a gasping breath. His pupils were blown wide. Something about it terrified her more than anything else he had ever done. Sebastian in control was frightening. Sebastian out of control was something too horrible to contemplate. "Let her go," said a clear, hard voice from across the room. "Let her go and stop touching her, or I will burn you down to ashes."
"Jace."
Over Sebastian's shoulder, she saw him, suddenly, where there had been no one standing a moment ago. He was in front of the window, the curtains blowing behind him in the breeze off the canal, and his eyes were as hard as agate stones. He was wearing gear, his blade in his hand, still with the shadow of fading bruises on his jaw and neck, and his expression as he looked at Sebastian was one of absolute loathing. Clary felt Sebastian's whole body tighten against hers. A moment later he had spun away from her, slamming his foot down on her sword, his hand flying to his belt. His smile was a razor slice, but his eyes were wary.
"Go ahead and try it," he said.
"You got lucky at the Citadel. I wasn't expecting you to burn like that when I cut you. My mistake. I won't make it twice."
Jace's eyes flicked to Clary once, a question in them. She nodded that she was all right.
"So you admit it," said Jace, circling a little closer to them.
The tread of his boots was soft on the wooden floor.
"The heavenly fire surprised you, threw you off your game. That's why you fled. You lost the battle at the Citadel, and you don't like to lose."
Sebastian's razor smile grew a little brighter, a little brittler.
"I didn't get what I came for, but I did learn quite a bit."
"You didn't break the walls of the Citadel," said Jace. "You didn't get into the armory. You didn't turn the sisters."
"I didn't go to the Citadel for arms and armor," Sebastian sneered. "I can get those easily. I came for you, the two of you."
Clary looked sideways at Jace. He was standing, expressionless and unmoving, his face as still as stone.
"You couldn't have known we'd be there," she said. "You're lying."
"I'm not."
He practically radiated like a torch burning. "I can see you, little sister. I can see everything that happens in Alicante. In the day and in the night. In darkness and in light. I can see you."
"Stop it," Jace said. "It's not true."
"Really?" Sebastian said.
How did I know Clary would be here, alone, tonight?
Jace went on prowling toward them, like a cat on the hunt.
How didn't she know that I would be here too?
Sebastian made a face. Hard to watch two people at once. So many irons in the fire.
And if you wanted Clary, why not just take her? Jace demanded. Why spend all this time talking?
His voice dripped contempt.
You want to go with you, he said. No one in your life has done anything but despise you. Your mother, your father, and now your sister.
Clary wasn't born with hate in her heart. You made her hate you.
But it wasn't what you wanted.
You forget we were bonded, you and I. You forget I've seen your dreams.
Somewhere inside that head of yours there is a world of flames. And there is you, looking down at it from a throne room. And in that room are two thrones.
So who occupies that second throne? Who sits beside you in your dreams?
Sebastian gave a gasping laugh. There were red spots on his cheeks, like fever.
You are making a mistake, he said, talking to me like this, angel boy.
Even in your dreams you are not companionless, Jace said, and now his voice was that voice Clary had first fallen in love with, the voice of the boy who had told her a story about a child and a falcon, and the lessons he had learned.
But who could you find who would understand you?
You don't understand love. Our father taught you too well. But you understand blood. Clary is your blood. If you could have her beside you, watching the world burn, it would be all the approval you ever needed.
I never desired approval, said Sebastian through gritted teeth. Yours, hers, or anyone's.
Really? Jace smiled as Sebastian's voice rose.
Then why have you given us so many second chances?
He had stopped prowling and stood opposite them, his pale gold eyes shining in the dim light.
You said it yourself. You stabbed me. You went for my shoulder.
You could have gone for the heart.
You were holding back.
For what? For me?
Or because in some tiny part of your brain you know that Clary would never forgive you if you ended my life?
Clary, do you wish to speak for yourself on this matter? Said Sebastian, though he never took his eyes from the blade in Jace's hands. Or do you require him to give answers for you?
Jace cut his eyes toward Clary, and Sebastian did as well. She felt the weight of both gazes on her for a moment, black and gold.
I'll never want to come with you, Sebastian, she said.
Jace is right. If the choice was to spend my life with you or die, I'd rather die.
Sebastian's eyes darkened.
You'll change your mind, he said. You'll mount that throne beside me of your own accord, when the end comes to the end. I've given you your chance to come willingly now. I've paid in blood and inconvenience to have you with me by your own choice, but I will take you unwilling just the same.
No, Clary said, just as a loud crash sounded from downstairs. The house was suddenly full of voices.
Oh, dear, said Jace, his voice dripping sarcasm. I just might have sent a fire message to the clave when I saw the body of the god you killed and shoved under that bridge.
Foolish of you not to dispose of it more carefully, Sebastian.
Sebastian's expression tightened, so momentarily that Clary imagined most people would never have noticed it. He reached for Clary, his lips shaping words. A spell to free her from whatever force held her clamped to the wall.
She pushed, shoved at him, and then Jace leapt at them, his blade driving down.
Sebastian spun away, but the blade had caught him. It drew a line of blood down his arm. He cried out, staggering back, and paused. He grinned as Jace stared at him, white-faced.
The heavenly fire, Sebastian said. You don't know how to control it yet.
Works sometimes and not other times, eh, little brother?
Jace's eyes blazed up in gold.
We'll see about that, he said, and lunged for Sebastian, sword slicing through the darkness with light. But Sebastian was too quick for it to matter.
He strode forward and plucked the sword out of Jace's hand. Clary struggled, but Sebastian's magic kept her pinned in place. Before Jace could move, Sebastian swung Jace's sword around and plunged it into his own chest. The tip sank in, parting his shirt, then his skin. He bled red, human blood, as dark as rubies. He was clearly in pain, his teeth bared in a rictus grin, his breath coming unevenly, but the sword kept moving, his hands steady. The back of his shirt bulged and tore as the tip of the sword broke through it on a gout of blood. Time seemed to stretch out like a rubber band. The hilt slammed up against Sebastian's chest, the blade protruding from his back, dripping scarlet. Jace stood shocked and frozen as Sebastian reached for him with bloody hands and pulled him close. Over the sound of feet pounding up the stairs, Sebastian spoke. "I can feel the fire of heaven in your veins, angel boy, burning under the skin," he said. "The pure force of destruction, of ultimate goodness. I can still hear your screams on the air when Clary plunged the blade into you. Did you burn and burn?" His breathless voice was dark with poisonous intensity. "You think you have a weapon you can use against me now, don't you? And perhaps with 50 years, 100, to learn to master the fire, you could. But time is exactly what you don't have. The fire rages, uncontrolled inside you, far more likely to destroy you than it is to ever destroy me." Sebastian raised a hand and cupped the back of Jace's neck, pulling him closer, so close their foreheads almost touched. "Clary and I are alike," he said. "And you are my mirror. One day she will choose me over you, I promise you that. And you will be there to see it." With a swift, darting motion, he kissed Jace on the cheek, fast and hard. When he drew back, there was a smear of blood there. "Away, Master Herondale," Sebastian said, and twisted the silver ring on his finger. There was a shimmer, and he vanished. Jace stared for a wordless moment at the place where Sebastian had been, then started toward Clary. Suddenly freed by Sebastian's disappearance, her legs had collapsed under her. She hit the ground on her knees and threw herself forward immediately, scrabbling for the blade of Hios Foros. Her hand closed around it, and she drew it close, curling her body around it, as if it were a child that needed protecting. "Clary! Clary!" Jace was there, sinking to his knees beside her, and his arms were around her. She rocked into them, pressing her forehead to his shoulder. She realized his shirt, and now her skin, was wet with her brother's blood, as the door burst open and the guards of the clave poured into the room.
"Here you go," said Leela Haryana, one of the newest of the pack's wolves, as she handed over a stack of clothes to Maya. Maya took them gratefully. "Thanks, you have no idea what it means to have clean clothes to wear," she said, glancing through a pile, a tank top, jeans, a wool jacket. She and Leela were about the same size, and even if the clothes didn't quite fit, it was better than going back to Jordan's apartment. It had been a while since Maya had lived at pack headquarters, and all her things were at Jordan's and Simon's, but the thought of the apartment without either of the boys in it was a dreary one. At least here she was surrounded by other werewolves, surrounded by the constant hum of voices, the smell of takeout Chinese and Malaysian food, the sound of people cooking in the kitchen. And Bat was there, not getting in her space, but always around if she wanted someone to talk to or just sit silently with, watching the traffic go by on Baxter Street. Of course there were always downsides. Rufus Hastings, huge and scarred and fearsome in his black leather biker clothes, seemed to be everywhere at once, his grating voice audible in the kitchen as he muttered over lunch about how Luke Garraway wasn't a reliable leader, he was going to marry an ex-shadow hunter, his loyalties were in question. They needed someone they could depend on to put werewolves first. "No problem." Leela fiddled with the gold clip in her dark hair, looking awkward. "Maya," she said, "just a word to the wise. You might want to tone down the whole loyalty to Luke thing." Maya froze. "I thought we were all loyal to Luke," she said in a careful tone. "And to Bat." If Luke were here, maybe, said Leela. But we've barely heard from him since he left for Idris. The Praetor is in a pack, but Sebastian threw the gauntlet down. He wants us to choose between the Shadow Hunters and going to war for them and...
There's always going to be war, Maya said in a low, furious voice. I'm not blindly loyal to Luke. I know Shadow Hunters. I've met Sebastian, too. He hates us. Trying to appease him, it isn't going to work.
Leela put her hands up.
Okay, like I said, just advice.
Hope those fit, she added and headed off down the hall.
Maya wiggled into the jeans, tight like she'd figured, and the shirt, and shrugged on Leela's jacket. She grabbed her wallet from the table, shoved her feet into her boots, and headed down the hall to knock on Bat's door. He opened it shirtless, which she hadn't been expecting. Aside from the scar along his right cheek, he had a scar on his right arm, where he'd been shot with a bullet, not silver. The scar looked like a moon crater, white against his dark skin. He raised an eyebrow.
Maya?
Look, she said. I'm going to tell off Rufus. He's filling everyone's head with crap, and I'm tired of it.
Whoa. Bat held up a hand. I don't think that's a good idea.
He's not going to stop unless someone tells him to, she said. I remember running into him at the Praetor with Jordan. Praetor Scott said Rufus had snapped another werewolf's leg for no reason. Some people see a power vacuum and they want to fill it. They don't care who they hurt.
Maya spun on her heel and headed downstairs. She could hear Bat making muffled cursing noises behind her.
A second later, he joined her on the steps, hastily pulling a shirt on.
Maya, I really don't...
There you are, she said. She had reached the lobby where Rufus was lounging against what had once been a sergeant's desk. A group of about 10 other werewolves, including Leela, were grouped around him.
Have to show him that we're stronger, he was saying, and that our loyalties lie with ourselves. The strength of the pack is the wolf, and the strength of the wolf is the pack.
His voice was as gravelly as Maya remembered it, as if something had injured his throat a long time ago. The deep scars on his face were livid against his pale skin. He smiled when he saw Maya.
Hello, he said. I believe we've met before. I was sorry to hear about your boyfriend.
I doubt that. Strength is loyalty and unity, not dividing people with lies, Maya snapped.
We've only just been reunited and you're calling me a liar? Rufus said. His demeanor was still casual, but there was a flicker of tension under it, like a cat readying itself to pounce.
If you're telling people that they should stay out of the Shadowhunters' war, then you're a liar. Sebastian isn't going to stop with the Nephilim. If he destroys them, then he'll come for us next.
He doesn't care about downworlders.
He just slaughtered the Praetor Lupus, Maya shouted. He cares about destruction. He will kill us all.
Not if we don't join with the Shadowhunters.
That's a lie, Maya said. She saw Bat pass a hand over his eyes. And then something struck her hard in the shoulder, knocking her backward. She was caught off her guard enough to stumble and then steadied herself on the edge of the desk.
Rufus, Bat roared, and Maya realized that Rufus had hit her in the shoulder.
She clamped her jaw shut, not wanting to give him the satisfaction of seeing the pain on her face.
Rufus stood smirking amid the suddenly frozen group of werewolves. Murmurs ran around the group as Bat strode forward. Rufus was enormous, towering over even Bat. His shoulders as thick and broad as a plank.
Rufus, Bat said, I'm the leader here, in Garraway's absence. You have been a guest among us, but are not of our pack. It's time for you to get out.
Rufus narrowed his eyes at Bat. Are you throwing me out, knowing I have nowhere to go?
I'm sure you'll find somewhere, Bat said, starting to turn away.
I challenge you, Rufus said. Bat Velasquez, I challenge you for the leadership of the New York Pack.
No, Maya said in horror, but Bat was already straightening his shoulders. His eyes met Rufus's. The tension between the two werewolves was as palpable as a live wire.
I accept your challenge, Bat said. Tomorrow night, in Prospect Park, I'll meet you there.
He spun on his heel and stalked out of the station. After a frozen moment, Maya dashed after him. The cold air hit her the minute she reached the front steps. Icy wind was swirling down Baxter Street, cutting through her jacket. She clattered down the stairs, her shoulder aching. Bat had nearly reached the corner of the street by the time she caught up with him, grabbing his arm and spinning him around to face her. She was aware that other people on the street were staring at them, and wished for a moment for the Shadow Hunter's glamour runes. Bat looked down at her. There was an angry line between his eyes, and his scar stood out, livid on his cheek. "Are you crazy?" she demanded. "How could you accept Rufus's challenge? He's huge." "You know the rules, Maya," said Bat. "A challenge has to be accepted." "Only if you're challenged by someone in your own pack, you could have turned him down." "And lost all the pack's respect," said Bat. "They never would have been willing to follow my orders again." "He'll kill you," Maya said, and wondered if he could hear what she was saying under the words. That she'd just watched Jordan die and didn't think she could stand it again. "Maybe not." He drew from his pocket something that clanked and jingled and pressed it into her hand. After a moment, she realized what it was. Jordan's keys. "His truck's parked around the corner," Bat said. "Take it and go. Stay away from the station until this is resolved. I don't trust Rufus around you." "Come with me," Maya begged. "You never cared about being pack leader. We could just go away until Luke comes back and sorts all this out." "Maya." Bat put his hand on her wrist, his fingers curling gently around her palm. "Waiting for Luke to get back is pretty much exactly what Rufus wants us to do. If we leave, we're abandoning the pack to him, basically. And you know what he'll choose to do, or not do. He'll let Sebastian slaughter all the Shadow Hunters without lifting a finger, and by the time Sebastian decides to come back and pick us all off like the last pieces on a chessboard, it'll be too late for everyone." Maya looked down at his fingers, gentle on her skin. "You know," he said, "I remember when you told me you needed more space, that you couldn't be in a real relationship. I took you at your word, and I gave you space. I even started dating that girl, the witch, what was her name?" "Eve," Maya supplied. "Right, Eve." Bat looked surprised that she remembered. "But that didn't work out, and anyway, maybe I gave you too much space. Maybe I should have told you how I felt. Maybe I should..." She looked up at him, startled and bewildered, and saw his expression change, the shutters going up behind his eyes, hiding his brief vulnerability. "Never mind," he said. "It's not fair to lay all this on you right now." He let go of her and stepped back. "Take the truck," he said, backing away from her into the crowd, heading toward Canal Street. "Get out of town and look after yourself, Maya. For me." Jace set his steely down on the arm of the sofa and traced a finger over the Arazi he had drawn on Clary's arm. A silver band glittered at his wrist. At some point, Clary didn't remember when, he had picked up Sebastian's fallen bracelet and clipped it onto his own wrist. She didn't feel like asking him why. "How's that?" "Better, thanks." Clary's jeans were rolled up above her knees. She watched as the bruises on her legs began to fade slowly. They were in a room in the guard, some kind of meeting space, Clary guessed. There were several tables and a long leather sofa angled in front of a low-burning fire. Books lined one of the walls. The room was illuminated by the firelight. The unshaded window gave out onto a view of Alicante and the shining demon towers. "Hey." Jace's light golden eyes searched her face. "Are you all right?" "Yes," she meant to say, but the reply stuck in her throat. Physically, she was fine. The runes had healed her bruises. She was all right. Jace was all right. Simon, knocked out by the spiked blood, had slept through it all and was currently still sleeping in another room in the guard. A message had been sent to Luke and Jocelyn. The dinner they were attending was warded for safety, Gia had explained, but they would receive it on leaving. Clary ached to see them again. The world felt unsteady under her feet. Sebastian was gone, for the moment at least, but she still felt torn apart, bitter and angry and vengeful and sad. The guards had let her pack a bag of things before she left Armitage's house. A change of clothes, her gear, her steely drawing pad and weapons. Part of her wanted to change her clothes desperately, to get rid of Sebastian's touch on the fabric. But more of her didn't want to leave the room, didn't want to be alone with her memories and thoughts. "I'm fine." She rolled the legs of her jeans down and stood up, walked over to the fireplace. She was aware of Jace watching her from the sofa. She put her hands out as if warming them at the fire, though she wasn't cold. In fact, every time the thought of her brother crossed her mind, she felt a surge of anger like liquid fire rip through her body. Her hands were shaking. She looked at them with strange detachment, as if they were a stranger's hands. "Sebastian's afraid of you," she said. "He played it off, especially at the end, but I could tell." "He's afraid of the heavenly fire," corrected Jace. "I don't think he's exactly sure what it does, any more than we are. One thing's for certain, though. It doesn't hurt him just to touch me." "No," she said, without turning around to look at Jace. "Why did he kiss you?" It wasn't what she'd meant to say, but she kept seeing it in her head over and over. Sebastian with his bloody hand curling around the back of Jace's neck, and then that strange and surprising kiss on the cheek. She heard the creak of the leather sofa as Jace shifted his weight. "It was a sort of quote," he said. "From the Bible, when Judas kissed Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane. It was a sign of his betrayal. He kissed him and said, 'Hail, Master,' to him, and that was how the Romans knew who to arrest and crucify." "That was why he said, 'Ave, Master,' to you," said Clary, realizing. "Hail, Master." "He meant he planned to be the instrument of my destruction." "Clary, I..." She turned to look at Jace as he broke off. He was sitting on the edge of the couch, running a hand through his messy blonde hair, his eyes fixed on the floor. "When I came into the room and saw you there and him there, I wanted to kill him. I should have attacked him immediately, but I was afraid it was a trap, that if I moved towards you, either of you, he would find a way to kill you or hurt you. He's always twisted everything I've ever done. He's clever, cleverer than Valentine, and I've never been..." She waited, the only sound in the room, the crackle and pop of the damp wood in the fireplace. "I've never been afraid of anyone like this," he finished, biting off the words as he spoke them. Clary knew what it cost Jace to say it, how much of his life had been expertly hiding fear and pain and any perceived vulnerability. She wanted to say something in reply, something about how he shouldn't be afraid, but she couldn't. She was afraid as well, and she knew they both had good reason to be. There was no one in Idris who had better reason than they did to be terrified. "He risked a lot coming here," Jay said. "He let the Clave know he can get in through the wards. They'll try to shore them up again. It might work, it might not, but it'll probably inconvenience him. He wanted to see you badly, badly enough to make it worth the risk." "He still thinks he can convince me." "Clary," Jace rose to his feet and moved towards her, his hand outstretched. "Are you..." She flinched, away from his touch. Startled light flared in his golden eyes. "What's wrong?" He glanced down at his hands. The faint glow of the fire in his veins was visible. "The heavenly fire?" "Not that," she said. "Then, Sebastian. I should have told you before, but I couldn't." He didn't move, just looked at her. "Clary, you can tell me anything. You know you can." She took a deep breath and stared into the fire, watching the flames, gold and green and sapphire blue, chase each other. "In November," she said, "before we came to the Burren, after you left the apartment, he realized I'd been spying. He crushed my ring and then he hit me, pushed me through a glass table. Knocked me to the ground, I almost killed him then, almost shoved a piece of glass through his throat, but I realized that if I did, I'd be killing you, and so I couldn't do it. And he was so delighted. He laughed and he shoved me down. He was pulling at my clothes and reciting pieces of the Song of Solomon, telling me about how brothers and sisters used to marry to keep royal bloodlines pure, how I belonged to him. Like I was a piece of monogrammed luggage with his name stamped on me." Jace looked shocked in a way she had rarely seen him shocked. She could read the levels of his expression, hurt, fear, apprehension. "Rape me?" she said, and the word was awful and ugly in the stillness of the room. "No, he didn't. He stopped." Her voice fell to a whisper. Jace was white as a sheet. He opened his mouth to say something to her, but she could hear only the distorted echo of his voice, as if she were underwater again. She was shaking all over, violently, though it was warm in the room. "Tonight," she said finally. "Couldn't move, and he pushed me up against the wall, and I couldn't get away, and I just..." "I'll kill him," Jace said. Some color had washed back into his face, and he looked gray. I'll cut him to pieces. I'll cut his hands off for touching you.
Jace, Clary said, feeling suddenly exhausted. We have a million reasons to want him dead. Besides, she added with a mirthless laugh, Isabel already cut his hand off and it didn't work.
Jace closed his hand into a fist, drew it up against his stomach, and dug it into his solar plexus as if he could cut off his own breath. All that time I was connected to him. I thought I knew his mind, his desires, what he wanted, but I didn't guess, I didn't know. And you didn't tell me.
This isn't about you, Jace.
I know, he said.
I know.
But his hand was so tightly fisted that it was white, the veins standing out in a stark topography across the back of it.
I know, and I don't blame you for not telling me. What could I have done? How am I not completely useless here? I was just standing 5 feet from him, and I have fire in my veins that ought to be able to kill him, and I tried, and it didn't work. I couldn't make it work.
Jace.
I'm sorry, it's just... You know me, I only have 2 reactions to bad news, uncontrollable rage, and then a sharp left turn into boiling self-hatred.
She was silent. Above everything else, she was tired, so tired. Telling him what Sebastian had done had been like lifting an impossible weight, and now all she wanted was to close her eyes and disappear into the darkness. She had been so angry for so long. Anger always under the surface of everything. Whether she was shopping for presents with Simon or sitting in the park or alone at home trying to draw, the anger was always with her. Jace was visibly struggling. He wasn't trying to hide anything from her, at least, and she saw the quick flicker of emotions behind his eyes. Rage, frustration, helplessness, guilt, and finally, sadness. It was a surprisingly quiet sadness for Jace, and when he spoke at last, his voice was surprisingly quiet too.
I just wish, he said, not looking at her but at the floor, that I could say the right thing, do the right thing to make this easier for you. Whatever you want from me, I want to do it. I want to be there for you in whatever the right way is for you, Clary.
There, she said softly. He looked up.
What?
What you just said. That was perfect.
He blinked.
Well, that's good because I'm not sure I have an encore in me. What part of it was perfect?
She felt her lip quirk slightly at the side. There was something so Jace about his reaction, his strange mixture of arrogance and vulnerability, of resilience and bitterness and devotion.
I just want to know, she said, that you don't think any differently of me, any less.
No, no, he said, appalled. You're brave and brilliant and you're perfect and I love you. I just love you and I always have, and the actions of some lunatic aren't going to change that.
Sit down, she said, and he sat down on the creaking leather sofa, his head tipped back, looking up at her. The reflected firelight clustered like sparks in his hair. She took a deep breath and walked over to him, settled herself carefully in his lap.
Could you hug me? She said.
He put his arms around her, held her against him. She could feel the muscles in his arms, the strength in his back as he put his hands on her gently, so gently. He had hands made for fighting, and yet he could be so gentle with her, with his piano, with all the things he cared about. She settled against him, sideways in his lap, her feet on the sofa, and leaned her head against his shoulder. She could feel the rapid beat of his heart.
Now, she said, kiss me too.
He hesitated.
You sure?
She nodded.
Yes, yes, she said. God knows we haven't exactly been able to do all that much lately, but every time I kiss you, every time you touch me, it's a victory, if you ask me. Sebastian, he did what he did because he doesn't understand the difference between loving and having, between giving yourself and taking, and he thought that if he could make me give myself, then he'd have me, I'd be his, and to him that's love because he doesn't know anything else. But when I touch you, I do it because I want to, and that's all the difference. And he doesn't get to have that or take it away from me. He doesn't, she said, and she leaned up to kiss him, a light touch of lips to lips, bracing her hand against the back of the sofa. She felt him draw in his breath at the slight spark that jumped between their skins. He brushed his cheek against hers, the strands of their hair tangling together, red and gold. She settled back down against him. The flames leaped in the grate,
and some of their warmth soaked into Clary's bones. She was resting against the shoulder that was marked with the white star of the men of the Herondale family, and she thought of all those who had gone before Jace, whose blood and bones and lives had made him what he was. "What are you thinking?" he said. He was drawing his hand through her hair, letting the loose curls slip between his fingers. "That I'm glad I told you," she said. "What are you thinking?" He was silent for a long moment as the flames rose and fell. Then he said, "I was thinking of what you said about Sebastian being lonely. I was trying to remember what it was like to be in that house with him. He took me for a lot of reasons, sure, but half of it was just to have company. The company of someone who he thought might understand him because we'd been raised the same. I was trying to remember if I'd ever actually liked him, liked spending time with him. I don't think so. Just from being there with you, you never seemed at ease. Not exactly. You were you, but not you. It's hard to explain." Jace looked at the fire. "Not that hard," he said. "I think there's a part of us separate even from our will or our minds, and it was that part he couldn't touch. It was never really exactly me, and he knew that. He wants to be liked or really loved for what he is, genuinely. But he doesn't think he has to change to be worthy of being loved. Instead, he wants to change the whole world, change humanity, make it into something that loves him." He paused. "Sorry about the armchair psychology. Literally, here we are, in an armchair." But Clary was deep in thought. "When I went through his things at the house, I found a letter he'd written. It wasn't finished, but it was addressed to my beautiful one. I remember thinking it was weird. Why would he be writing a love letter? I mean, he understands sex, sort of, and desire, but romantic love? Not from what I've seen." Jace drew her up against him, fitting her more neatly against the curve of his side. She wasn't sure who was soothing whom, just that his heart beat steadily against her skin, and the soap, sweat, metal smell of him was familiar and comforting. Clary softened against him, exhaustion catching her up and dragging her down, weighting her eyelids. It had been a long, long day and night, and a long day before that. "If my mom and Luke get here while I'm sleeping, wake me up," she said. "Oh, you'll be woken up," Jay said drowsily. "Your mother will think I'm trying to take advantage of you and chase me around the room with a fireplace poker." She reached up to pat his cheek. "I'll protect you." Jace didn't reply. He was already asleep, breathing steadily against her, the rhythms of their heartbeats slowing to match each other. She lay awake as he slept, looking into the leaping flames and frowning, the words, "my beautiful one," echoing in her ears like the memory of words heard in a dream. 11. The best is lost. "Clary, Jace, wake up." Clary raised her head and almost yelped as a twinge shot through her stiff neck. She'd fallen asleep curled up against Jace's shoulder. He was asleep too, wedged into the corner of the sofa with his jacket wadded up under his head as a pillow. The hilt of his sword dug uncomfortably into Clary's hip as he groaned and straightened up. The consul stood over them, dressed in council robes, unsmiling. Jace scrambled to his feet. "Consul," he said in as dignified a voice as he could muster with his clothes rumpled and his light hair sticking out in every possible direction. "We nearly forgot the two of you were in here," Gia said. "The council meeting has begun." Clary got to her feet more slowly, working out the cricks in her back and neck. Her mouth was as dry as chalk and her body ached with tension and exhaustion. "Where's my mother?" she said. "Where's Luke?" "I'll wait for you in the hall," Gia said, but she didn't move. Jace was sliding his arms into his jacket. "We'll be right along, Consul." There was something in the Consul's voice that made Clary look at her again. Gia was pretty, like her daughter, Aline, but at the moment there were sharp lines of tension at the corners of her mouth and eyes. Clary had seen that look before. "What's going on?" she demanded. "There's something wrong, isn't there? Where's my mother? Where's Luke?" "We're not sure," Gia said quietly. "They never responded to the message we sent to them last night." Too many shocks, delivered too quickly, had left Clary numb. She didn't gasp or exclaim, only felt a coldness spread through her veins. She seized up Hyosphorus from the table where she'd left it and shoved it through her belt. Without another word, she pushed past the consul into the hallway outside. Simon was waiting there. He looked rumpled and exhausted, pale even for a vampire. She reached to squeeze his hand, fingers brushing the gold leaf ring on his finger as she did. "Simon's coming to the council meeting," Clary said, her look daring the consul to say anything in return. Gia simply nodded. She looked like someone who was too tired to argue anymore. "He can be the Night Children's representative."
"But Raphael was going to stand in for the representative," Simon protested, alarmed. "I'm not prepared."
"We haven't been able to reach any of the Downworld representatives, Raphael included." Gia began to make her way down the hall. The walls were wood, with the pale color and sharp scent of freshly cut lumber. This must have been part of the guard that had been rebuilt after the Mortal War. Clary had been too tired to notice the night before. Runes of angelic power were cut into the walls at intervals. Each glowed with a deep light, illuminating the windowless corridor. "What do you mean you haven't been able to reach them?" Clary demanded, hurrying after Gia. Simon and Jace followed. The corridor curved, leading deeper into the heart of the guard. Clary could hear a dull roar like the sound of the ocean just ahead of them. "Neither Luke nor your mother came back from their appointment at the House of the Fairfolk." The consul paused in a large antechamber. There was a good deal of natural light here, pouring through windows made up of alternating squares of plain and colored glass. Double doors stood before them, blazoned with the triptych of the angel and the mortal instruments. "I don't understand," Clary said, her voice rising. "So they're still there? At Meliorn's?" Gia shook her head. "The house is empty."
"But what about Meliorn? What about Magnus?"
"Nothing is certain yet," Gia said. "There is no one in the house, nor are any of the representatives responding to messages. Patrick is out searching the city now with a team of guards."
"Was there blood in the house?" Jace asked. "Signs of a struggle, anything?"
Gia shook her head. "No, the food was still on the table. It was as if they just vanished into thin air."
"There's more, isn't there?" Clary said. "I can tell by your expression that there's more."
Gia didn't answer, just pushed the door of the council room open. Noise poured out into the antechamber. This was the sound Clary had been hearing, like the crash of the ocean. She hurried past the consul and paused in the doorway, hovering uncertainly. The council room, so orderly only a few days before, was full of shouting shadow hunters. Everyone was standing, some in groups and some apart. Most of the groups were arguing. Clary couldn't make out the words, but she could see the angry gestures. Her eyes scanned the crowd for familiar faces. No Luke, no Jocelyn, but there were the Lightwoods. Robert in his inquisitor's robes beside Maris. There were Aline and Helen and the crowd of Blackthorn children. And there, down in the center of the amphitheater, were the four carved wooden seats of the Downworlders, set around the lecterns in a half circle. They were empty, and splashed across the floorboards in front of them was a single word, scrawled in a crooked hand in what looked like sticky gold paint. Vienni. Jace moved past Clary, into the room. His shoulders were tight as he stared down at the scroll. "That's Ichor," he said. "Angel blood." In a flash, Clary saw the library at the Institute, the floor slicked with blood and feathers, the angel's hollow bones. "Erchome, I am coming." And now the single word, "Vieni, I have come." A second message. Oh, Sebastian had been busy. Stupid, she thought, so stupid of her. To think he'd come for only her, that it hadn't been part of something larger, that he hadn't wanted more destruction, more terror, more upheaval. She thought of his smirk when she'd mentioned the battle at the Citadel. Of course it had been more than an attack. It had been a distraction. Turning the gaze of the Nephilim outward from Alicante, making them search the world for him and his Indarkand, panicking them over the wounded and dead. And in the meantime, Sebastian had found his way to the heart of the guard and painted the floor in blood. Near the dais was a group of silent brothers in their bone-colored robes, faces hidden by hoods. Her memory sparking, Clary turned to Jace. "Brother Zachariah, I never got a chance to ask you if you knew whether he was all right." Jace was staring at the writing on the dais, a sick look on his face. "I saw him in the Basilius. He's all right. He's different."
"Good different?"
"Human different," Jace said, and before Clary could ask him what he meant, she heard someone call her name. Down in the center of the room, she saw a hand rise out of the crowd, waving toward her frantically. Isabel. She was standing with Alec a little distance from their parents. Clary heard Gia call out after her, but she was pushing through the crowd already, Jason Simon at her heels. She sensed curious stares being cast in her direction. Everyone knew who she was, after all. Knew who they all were. Valentine's daughter, Valentine's adopted son, and the Daylighter vampire. Clary! Isabel called as Clary Jason Simon pulled free of the staring onlookers and nearly fell into the Lightwood siblings, who had managed to clear a small space for themselves in the middle of the crowd. Isabel shot an irritated glance at Simon before reaching out to hug Jason Clary. As soon as she released Jace, Alec pulled him over by the sleeve and hung on, his knuckles whitening around the fabric. Jace looked surprised but said nothing. "Is it true?" Isabel said to Clary. "Sebastian was at your house last night." "At Armitage's, yes. How did you know?" Clary demanded. "Our father's the Inquisitor, of course we know," said Alec. "Rumors about Sebastian being in the city were all everyone was talking about before they opened up the council room and we saw... this." "It's true," Simon added. "The council asked me about it when she woke me up, like I know anything. I slept through it," he added as Isabel shot him an inquiring look. "Did the council say anything to you about this?" Alec demanded, sweeping an arm towards the grim scene below. "Did Sebastian?" "No," Clary said. "Sebastian doesn't exactly share his plans. He shouldn't have been able to get to the Downworld representatives. Not only is Alicante guarded, but each of their safe houses is warded," said Alec. There was a pulse going on in his throat like a hammer. His hand, where it rested on Jace's sleeve, was shaking with a fine tremor. "They were at dinner. They should have been safe." He let go of Jace and jammed his hands into his pockets. "And Magnus wasn't even supposed to be here. Katerina was coming instead of him." He looked at Simon. "I saw you with him in Angel Square on the night of the battle," he said. "Did he say why he was in Alicante?" Simon shook his head. "He just shooed me away. He was healing Clary." "Maybe this is a bluff," Alec said. "Maybe... Sebastian is trying to make us think he's done something to the Downworld representatives to throw us off. We don't know that he's done anything to them, but they are missing," Jay said quietly, and Alec looked away as if he couldn't bear to meet their gazes. "Yenny," Isabel whispered, looking at the dais. "Why?" "He's telling us he has power," Clary said. "Power none of us even begin to understand." She thought of the way he'd appeared in her room and then disappeared, of the way the ground had opened under his feet at the Citadel as if the Earth were welcoming him in, hiding him from the threat of the world above. A sharp report rang out through the room. The bell had called the council to order. Gia had moved to the lectern, an armed Clave guard in hooded robes on either side of her. "Shadow hunters," she said as the word echoed clearly through the room as if she'd used a microphone. "Please be silent." The room subsided gradually into quiet, though from the rebellious looks on quite a few faces, it was an uncooperative quiet. "Consul Penhallow," called out Kadir. "What answers do you have for us? What is the meaning of this desecration?" "We're not sure," said Gia. "It happened in the night, in between one watch of guards and another." "This is vengeance," said a thin, dark-haired shadow hunter whom Clary recognized as the head of the Budapest Institute. "Laszlo Balol," she thought his name was. "Vengeance for our victories in London and at the Citadel." "We didn't have victories in London and at the Citadel, Laszlo," said Gia. "The London Institute turned out to be protected by a force even we were unaware of, one we cannot replicate. The shadow hunters there were warned and led to safety. Even then, a few were injured. None of Sebastian's forces were harmed. At best, it could be called a successful retreat." "But the attack on the Citadel," Laszlo protested. "He did not enter the Citadel. He did not reach the armory there." "But neither did he lose. We sent through 60 warriors, and he killed 30 and injured 10. He had 40 warriors, and he lost perhaps 15. If it hadn't been for what happened when he wounded Jace Lightwood, his 40 would have slaughtered our 60. "We're shadow hunters," said Nazreen Chowdhury. We are used to defending that which we must defend with our last breaths, our last drops of blood.
A noble idea, said Josiane Pontmercy, from the Marseille Conclave, but perhaps not entirely practical.
We were too conservative in the number we sent to face him at the Citadel, said Robert Lightwood, his booming voice carrying through the room. We have estimated since the attacks that Sebastian has 400 Endarkened warriors on his side. Simply given the numbers, a head-to-head battle now between his forces and all Shadow Hunters would mean that he would lose.
So what we need to do is fight him as soon as possible before he turns any other Shadow Hunters, said Diana Rayburn.
You can't fight what you can't find, said the Consul. Our attempts to track him continue to prove fruitless. She raised her voice. Sebastian Morgenstern's best plan now is to lure us out in small numbers. He needs us to send out scouting parties to hunt demons or to hunt him. We must stay together here in Idris, where he cannot confront us. If we split up, if we leave our homeland, then we will lose.
He'll wait us out, said a blonde shadow hunter from the Copenhagen Conclave.
We have to believe he doesn't have the patience for that, said Gia. We have to assume he will attack, and when he does, our superior numbers will defeat him.
There's more than patience to be considered, said Balog. We left our institutes. We came here with the understanding that we would be returning once we had held a council with the downworld representatives. Without us out in the world, who will protect it? We have a mandate from heaven. To protect the world, to hold back demons. We cannot do that from Idris.
All the wards are at full strength, said Robert. Wrangel Island is working overtime, and given our new cooperation with Downworlders, we will have to rely on them to keep the accords. That was part of what we were going to discuss at the council today.
Well, good luck to you with that, said Josiane Pontmercy. Considering that the representatives of Downworld are missing.
Missing. The word fell into the silence like a pebble into water, sending out ripples through the room. Clary felt Alex stiffen minutely at her side. She hadn't been letting herself think about it, hadn't been letting herself believe that they could really be gone. It was a trick Sebastian was playing on them, she kept telling herself. A cruel trick, but nothing more.
We don't know that, Gia protested. Guards are out searching now.
Sebastian rolled on the floor in front of their very seats, shouted a man with a bandaged arm. He was the head of the Mexico City Institute and had been at the Citadel battle. Clary thought his last name was Rosales.
Vanny, I am calm. Just as he sent us a message with the death of the angel in New York, now he strikes at us in the heart of the guard.
But he didn't strike at us, Diana interrupted. He struck at the representatives of Downworld.
To strike at our allies is to strike at us, called Maris. They are members of the council with all the attendant rights that represents.
We don't even know what happened to them, snapped someone in the crowd. They could be perfectly all right.
Then where are they? Shouted Alec, and even Jace looked startled to hear Alec raise his voice.
Alec was glowering, his blue eyes dark, and Clary was suddenly reminded of the angry boy she had met in the institute what felt like so long ago.
Has anyone tried to track them?
We have, said Gia. It hasn't worked. Not all of them can be tracked. You cannot track a warlock or the dead.
Gia broke off with a sudden gasp. Without warning, the clave guard on her left had come up behind her and seized her by the back of her robes. A shout ran through the assembly as he yanked her back, placing the blade of a long silver dagger against her throat.
Nephilim! He roared, and his hood fell away, showing the blank eyes and swirling, unfamiliar marks of the Endarkened. A roar began to rise from the crowd, cut off quickly as the guard dug his blade farther into Gia's throat. Blood bloomed around it, visible even from a distance.
Nephilim! The man roared again. Clary's mind struggled to place him. He seemed somehow familiar. He was tall, brown-haired, probably around 40. His arms were thickly muscled, the veins standing out like ropes as he struggled to hold Gia still.
Stay where you are. Do not approach or your consul dies.
Aline screamed. Helen had hold of her, visibly restraining her from running forward. Behind them, the Blackthorn children huddled around Julian, who was carrying his youngest brother in his arms.
Drusilla had her face pressed against his side. Emma, her hair bright even at a distance, stood with Cortana out, protecting the others.
"That's Matthias Gonzalez," said Alec in a shocked voice. "He was head of the Buenos Aires Institute."
"Silence," roared the man behind GM Matthias, and an uneasy silence fell. Most Shadow Hunters stood, like Jace and Alec, with their hands halfway to their weapons. Isabel was clutching the handle of her whip.
"Hear me, Shadow Hunters," Matthias cried, his eyes burning with a fanatic light. "Hear me, for I was one of you, blindly following the rule of the Clave, convinced of my own safety within the wards of Idris, protected by the light of the Angel. But there is no safety here." He jerked his chin to the side, indicating the scroll on the floor. "None are safe, not even Heaven's messengers. That is the reach of the power of the Infernal Cup and of he who holds it." A murmur ran through the crowd. Robert Lightwood pushed forward, his face anxious as he looked at Gia and the blade at her throat.
"What does he want?" he demanded. "Valentine's son, what does he want from us?"
"Oh, he wants many things," said the Indarkin Shadow Hunter. "But for now, he will content himself with the gift of his sister and adopted brother. Give him Clarissa Morgenstern and Jace Lightwood and avert disaster."
Clary heard Jace suck in his breath. She looked at him, panicking. She could feel the gaze of the whole room on her and felt as if she were dissolving like salt in water.
"We are Nephilim," Robert said coldly. "We do not trade away our own. He knows that."
"We of the Infernal Cup have in our possession 5 of your allies," was the reply. "Meliorn of the Fair Folk, Raphael Santiago of the Night's Children, Luke Garraway of the Moon's Children, Jocelyn Morgenstern of the Nephilim, and Magnus Bane of the Children of Lilith. If you do not give us Clarissa and Jonathan, they will be put to the deaths of iron and silver, of fire and ruin. And when your downworld allies learn that you have sacrificed their representatives because you would not give up your own, they will turn on you. They will join with us, and you will find yourselves fighting not just he who holds the Infernal Cup, but all of Downworld."
Clary felt a wave of dizziness, so intense it was almost sickness, pass over her. She had known, of course she had known, with a creeping knowledge that was not certainty and could not be dismissed, that her mother and Luke and Magnus were in danger, but to hear it was something else. She began to shiver, the words of an incoherent prayer repeating over and over in her head. "Mom, Luke, be all right, please be all right. Let Magnus be all right for Alec, please." She heard Isabel's voice in her head too, saying that Sebastian could not fight them in all of Downworld. But he had found a neat way to turn it back on them. If harm came to the Downworld representatives now, it would seem the Shadow Hunter's fault. Jace's expression had gone bleak, but he met her eyes with the same understanding that had lodged like a needle in her heart. They could not stand back and let this happen. They would go to Sebastian. It was the only choice. She started forward, meaning to call out, but she found herself jerked back by a hard grip on her wrist. She turned, expecting Simon, and saw to her surprise that it was Isabel.
"Don't," Isabel said.
"You are a fool and a follower," snapped Kadir, his eyes angry as he regarded Matthias.
"No Downworlders will hold us accountable for not sacrificing 2 of our children to Jonathan Morgenstern's pyre of corpses."
"Oh, but he will not kill them," said Matthias with vicious glee.
"You have his word on the Angel that no harm will come to the Morgenstern girl or the Lightwood boy. They are his family, and he desires them by his side. So there is no sacrifice."
Clary felt something brush her cheek. It was Jace. He had kissed her quickly, and she remembered Sebastian's Judas kiss the night before and whirled to catch at him, but he was gone already, away from all of them, striding out onto the aisle of stairs between the benches.
"I will go," he shouted, and his voice rang through the room. "I will go, willingly."
His sword was in his hand. He threw it down where it clattered on the steps.
"I will go with Sebastian," he said into the silence that followed. "Just leave Clary out of it. Let her stay. Take me alone."
"Jace, no," Alec said, but his voice was drowned by the clamor that ran through the room, voices rising like smoke and curling up toward the ceiling, and Jace stood calmly, with his hands out showing he had no weapons, his hair shining under the light of the runes. A sacrificial angel. Matthias Gonzalez laughed.
There will be no bargain without Clarissa, he said. Sebastian demands her, and I deliver what my master demands.
You think we're fools, Jace said. Actually, I know better than that. You don't think at all. You're a mouthpiece for a demon, that's all you are. You don't care about anything anymore, not family or blood or honor. You're no longer human.
Matthias sneered. Why would anyone want to be human?
Because your bargain is worthless, said Jace.
So we give ourselves up, and Sebastian returns his hostages, then what?
You've been at such pains to tell us how much better he is than the Nephilim, how much stronger, how much cleverer, how he can strike at us here in Alicante, and all our wards and all our guards can't keep him out, how he'll destroy us all. If you want to bargain with someone, you offer them a chance to win. If you were human, you'd know that.
In the silence that followed, Clary thought you could hear a drop of blood strike the floor. Matthias was still, his blade still pinned against Gia's throat, his lips shaping words as if he were whispering something or reciting something he had heard. Or listening, she realized, listening to words being whispered in his ear.
You cannot win, Matthias said finally, and Jace laughed, that sharp, acerbic laugh Clary had first fallen in love with.
Not a sacrificial angel, she thought, but an avenging one, all gold and blood and fire, confident even in the face of defeat.
You see what I mean, Jace said. Then what does it matter if we die now or die later?
You cannot win, said Matthias, but you can survive. Those of you who choose it can be changed by the Infernal Cup. You will become soldiers of the Morning Star, and you will rule the world with Jonathan Morgenstern as your leader. Those who choose to remain the children of Raziel may do so, as long as you remain in Idris. The borders of Idris will be sealed, closing it away from the rest of the world, which will belong to us. This land granted to you by the Angel you will keep, and keeping within its borders you will be safe. That you can be promised.
Jace glared. Sebastian's promises mean nothing.
His promises are all you have, said Matthias. Keep your alliance with Downworlders, stay within the borders of Idris, and you will survive. But this offer stands only so long as you give yourselves willingly up to our master. You and Clarissa both, there is no negotiation.
Clary looked slowly around the room. Some of the Nephilim looked anxious, others fearful, others full of rage, and others were calculating. She remembered the day when she had stood up in the Hall of Accords in front of these same people and showed them the binding rune that could win their war. They had been grateful then. But this was also the same council who had voted to cease searching for Jace when Sebastian had taken him, because one boy's life had not been worth their resources. Especially when that boy had been Valentine's adopted son. She had thought once that there were good people and bad people, that there was a side of light and a side of darkness, but she no longer thought that. She had seen evil in her brother and her father, the evil of good intentions gone wrong, and the evil of sheer desire for power. But in goodness there was also no safety. Virtue could cut like a knife, and the fire of heaven was blinding. She moved away from Alec and Isabel, felt Simon catch at her arm. She turned and looked at him and shook her head.
You have to let me do this. His dark eyes pleaded with her.
Don't, he whispered.
He said both of us, she whispered back. If Jace goes to Sebastian without me, Sebastian will kill him.
He'll kill you both anyway, Isabel was nearly crying with frustration. You can't go, and Jace can't either. Jace!
Jace turned to look at them. Clary saw his expression change as he realized she was struggling to get to him. He shook his head, mouthing the word, no.
Give us time, Robert Lightwood called. Give us some time to cast a vote, at least.
Matthias drew the knife away from Gia's throat and held it aloft. His other arm circled her, his hand gripping the front of her robes. He raised the knife toward the ceiling and light sparked off it at the gesture.
Time? He sneered. Why should Sebastian give you time?
A sharp singing noise cut the air. Clary saw something bright shoot past her and heard the noise of metal striking metal as an arrow slammed into the knife Matthias held above Gia's head, knocking it free of his grasp. Clary whipped her head sideways and saw Alec, his bow raised, the string still vibrating. Matthias let out a roar and staggered back, his hand bleeding. Gia darted away from him as he dived for his fallen blade. Clary heard Jace call out. Nakia! He had drawn a seraph blade from his belt and its light illuminated the hall. Get out of my way, he shouted, and began to shoulder his way down the steps toward the dais. No! Alec, dropping his bow, flung himself over the back of the row of benches and dived on top of Jace, knocking him to the ground just as the dais went up in flames like a bonfire doused with gasoline. Gia cried out and leaped from the platform into the crowd. Kadia caught her and lowered her gently as all the shadow hunters turned to stare at the rising flames. What the hell? Simon whispered, his fingers still clasped around Clary's arm. She could see Matthias, a black shadow at the heart of the flames. They were clearly not harming him. He seemed to be laughing, throwing up his arms over and over as if he were a conductor directing an orchestra of fire. The room was full of shrieks and the stink and crackle of burning wood. Aline had run to clutch at her bleeding mother, weeping. Helen was watching helplessly as, along with Julian, she tried to shield the younger Blackthorns from what was happening below. No one was shielding Emma, though. She was standing apart from the group, her small face white with shock as, over the already horrible sounds filling the room, Matthias's cries pierced the din. 2 days, Nephilim! You have 2 days to decide your fate. And then you will all burn. You will burn in the fires of hell, and the ashes of Eden will cover your bones. His voice rose to an unearthly shriek and was suddenly silenced as the flames dropped away and he disappeared along with them. The last of the embers licked across the floor, their glowing tips barely touching the message still scrawled in ichor across the dais. Vieni, I have come. It had taken Maya 2 minutes of deep breathing outside the apartment door before she could bring herself to slide the key into the lock. Everything in the hallway seemed normal, eerily so. Jordan's coats and Simon's hung on pegs in the narrow entranceway. The walls were decorated with street signs bought from flea markets. She moved into the living room, which seemed frozen in time. The TV was on, the screen showing dark static, the 2 game controllers still on the couch. They'd forgotten to turn off the coffee pot. She went and flipped the switch, trying as hard as she could to ignore all the pictures of herself and Jordan stuck to the fridge. Them on the Brooklyn Bridge, drinking coffee at the Waverly Place Diner, Jordan laughing and showing off his fingernails, which Maya had painted blue and green and red. She hadn't realized how many pictures he'd taken of them, as if he'd been trying to record every second of their interactions, lest they slip through his memories like water. She had to steel herself again before she could go into the bedroom. The bed was still mussed and untucked. Jordan had never been particularly neat, his clothes scattered around the room. Maya went across the room to the bureau where she'd kept her own belongings and stripped off Leela's clothes. With relief, she threw on her own jeans and t-shirt. She was reaching to pull out a coat when the doorbell rang. Jordan had kept his weapons issued to him by the praetor in the trunk at the foot of the bed. She flung the trunk open and scooped up a heavy iron vial with a cross carved into the front. She flung on her coat and stalked into the living room, the vial in her pocket, her fingers wrapped around it. She reached out and yanked the front door open. The girl who stood on the other side had dark hair falling sheer to her shoulders. Against it, her skin was dead white, her lips dark red. She wore a severely tailored black suit. She was a modern Snow White in blood, char, and ice. You called me, she said. Jordan Kyle's girlfriend, am I correct? Lily, she's one of the smartest of the vampire clan, knows everything. She and Raphael were always thick as thieves. Don't act like you don't know, Lily, Maya snapped. You've been here before. I'm pretty sure you grabbed Simon from this apartment for Maureen. And? Lily crossed her arms, making her expensive suit crackle. Are you going to invite me in or not? I'm not, said Maya. We're going to talk here in the hallway. Dull? Lily leaned back against the wall with its peeling paint and made a face. Why did you summon me here, werewolf?
Maureen is crazy, said Maya. Raphael and Simon are gone. Sebastian Morgenstern is murdering downworlders to make a point to the Nephilim. And maybe it's time for the vampires and lycanthropes to talk, even to ally.
Well, aren't you as cute as a bug's ear? Lily said and stood up straight.
Look, Maureen's crazy, but she's still the clan leader, and I can tell you one thing. She isn't going to parlay with some jumped-up pack member who's lost a plot because her boyfriend died.
Maya tightened her grip on the bottle in her hand. She yearned to throw the contents in Lily's face so much that it frightened her.
Call me when you're the pack leader.
There was a dark light in the vampire girl's eyes, as if she were trying to tell Maya something without saying the words.
And we'll talk then.
Lily turned and clicked off down the hallway on her high heels. Slowly, Maya loosened her grip on the bottle of holy water in her pocket.
Nice shot, Jace said. You don't need to make fun of me. Alec and Jace were in one of the guards' dizzying array of meeting rooms. Not the same room Jace had been in earlier with Clary, but another more austere room in an older part of the guard. The walls were stone, and there was one long bench that ran across the west wall. Jace was kneeling on it, his jacket thrown aside, the right sleeve of his shirt rolled up. I'm not, Jace protested, as Alec set the tip of his steely to the bare skin of Jace's arm. As the dark lines began to spiral out from the Atomus, Jace couldn't help but remember another day in Alicante, Alec bandaging Jace's hand, telling him angrily, You can heal slow and ugly like a mundane. Jace had put his hand through a window that day. He deserved everything Alec had said to him. Alec exhaled slowly. He was always very careful with his runes, especially the Arazis. He seemed to feel the slight burn, the sting against the skin that Jace felt, though Jace had never minded the pain. The map of white scars that covered his biceps and ran down to his forearm attested to that. There was a special strength to a rune given by your Parabatai. It was why they had sent the two of them away, while the rest of the Lightwood family met in the consul's offices, so that Alec could heal Jace as quickly and efficiently as possible. Jace had been rather startled. He'd half expected them to make him sit through the meeting with his wrist blue and swelling up. I'm not, Jace said again, as Alec finished and stepped back to examine his handiwork. Already, Jace could feel the numbing of the Arazi spreading through his veins, soothing the pain in his arm, sealing his split lip. You hit Matthias's knife from halfway across an amphitheater. Clean shot. Didn't hit Gia at all. And he was moving around, too. I was motivated. Alec slid his steely back into his belt. His dark hair hung raggedly into his eyes. He hadn't gotten it properly cut since he and Magnus had broken up. Magnus. Jace closed his eyes. Alec, he said. I'll go. You know I'll go. You're saying that like you think it'll reassure me, said Alec. You think I want you to give yourself up to Sebastian? Are you crazy? I think it might be the only way to get Magnus back. Jace spoke into the darkness behind his eyelids. And you're willing to barter Clary's life, too. Alec's tone was acid. Jace's eyes flew open. Alec was looking at him steadily, but without expression. No, Jace said, hearing the defeat in his own voice. I couldn't do that. And I wouldn't ask it, said Alec. This is what Sebastian's trying to do. Drive wedges between all of us, using the people we love as hooks to pull us apart. We shouldn't let him. When did you get so wise? Jace said. Alec laughed, a short, brittle laugh. The day I'm wise is the day you're careful. Maybe you've always been wise, Jace said. I remember when I asked if you wanted to be Parabatai, and you said you needed a day to think about it. And then you came back and said yes. And when I asked you why you agreed to do it, you said it was because I needed someone to look after me. You were right. I never thought about it again, because I never had to. I had you, and you've always looked after me. Always. Alec's expression tightened. Jace could almost see the tension thrumming through his Parabatai's veins. Don't, Alec said. Don't talk like that. Why not? Because, Alec said.
That's how people talk when they think they're going to die.
If Clary and Jace are delivered to Sebastian, then they will be delivered to their deaths, said Maris. They were in the offices of the consul, likely the most plushly decorated room in all the guard. A thick rug was underfoot, the stone walls spread with tapestries, a massive desk standing diagonally across the room. On one side of it was Gia Penhallow, the cut on her throat sealing as her erazes took effect. Behind her chair stood her husband, Patrick, his hand on her shoulder. Facing them were Maris and Robert Lightwood. To Clary's surprise, she, Isabel, and Simon had all been allowed to stay in the room as well. It was her own and Jace's fate they were discussing, she supposed, but then the Clave had never before seemed to have much in the way of a problem with deciding people's fates without their input. "Sebastian says he won't hurt them," said Gia. "His word's worthless," Isabel snapped. "He lies, and it doesn't mean anything if he swears on the angel, because he doesn't care about the angel. He serves Lilith if he serves anyone." There was a soft click, and the door opened, admitting Alec and Jace. Jace and Alec had tumbled down quite a few stairs, and Jace had gotten the worst of it, with a split lip and a wrist that had either been broken or twisted. It looked back to normal now, though. He tried to smile at Clary as he came in, but his eyes were haunted. "You have to understand how the Clave will see it," Gia said. "You fought Sebastian at the Burren. They were told, but they didn't see, not until the Citadel, the difference between Endarkened warriors and Shadow Hunters. There has never been a race of warriors more powerful than Nephilim. Now there is. The reason he attacked the Citadel was to gather information," said Jace. "He wanted to know what the Nephilim were capable of, not just the group we could scramble together at the Burren, but warriors sent to fight by the Clave. He wanted to see how they stood up against his forces." "He was taking our measure," said Clary. "He was weighing us in the balance." Gia looked at her. "Mene, mene, tekel ufarsin," she said softly. "You are right when you said Sebastian doesn't want to fight a big battle," said Jace. "His interest is to fight a lot of small battles where he can turn a bunch of Nephilim, add to his forces, and it might have worked to stay in Idris, let him bring the battle here, break the tide of his army on the rocks of Alicante. Except now that he's taken the Downworld representative, staying here won't work. Without us watching, with the Downworld turning against us, the Accords will fall apart. The world will fall apart." Gia's gaze went to Simon. "What do you say, Downworlder? Was Matthias correct? If we refuse to ransom Sebastian's hostages, will it mean war with Downworld?" Simon looked startled to be addressed in such an official capacity. Consciously or unconsciously, his hand had gone to Jordan's medallion at his throat. He held it as he spoke. "I think," he said with reluctance, "that though there are some Downworlders who would be reasonable, the vampires wouldn't. They already believe Nephilim set a light price on their lives. Warlocks," he shook his head, "I don't really understand warlocks, or fairies. I mean, the Sealy Queen seems to look out for herself. She helped Sebastian with these." He held up his hand where his ring glimmered. "It seems likely that was less about helping Sebastian than about her own insatiable desire to know everything," Robert said. "It is true she did spy on you, but Sebastian was not known to be our enemy then. More tellingly, Melion has sworn up and down that the fair folk's loyalty is to us, and that Sebastian is their enemy and fairies cannot lie." Simon shrugged. "Anyway, my point is that I don't understand how they think. But the werewolves love Luke. They'll be desperate to get him back." "He used to be a shadow hunter," Robert began. "That makes it worse," said Simon. And it wasn't Simon, Clary's oldest friend, talking, but someone else, someone knowledgeable about Downworld politics. "They see the way Nephilim treat Downworlders, who were once Nephilim, as evidence of the fact that shadow hunters believe Downworld blood is tainted. Magnus told me once about a dinner he was invited to at an institute for Downworlders and Shadowhunters alike. Afterward, the Shadowhunters threw out all the plates because Downworlders had touched them." "Not all Nephilim are like that," Maris said. Simon shrugged. "The first time I ever came to the guard, it was because Alec brought me," he said. "I trusted that the consul only wanted to talk to me. Instead, I was thrown into prison and starved. Luke's own Parabatai told him to kill himself when Luke was turned.
The Praetor Lupus has been burned to the ground by someone who, even if he is an enemy of Idris, is a shadow hunter.
So you're saying, yes, it will be war? Asked Gia.
It's already war, isn't it? Said Simon. Weren't you just injured in a battle? I'm just saying Sebastian is using the cracks in your alliances to break you, and he's doing it well. Maybe he doesn't understand humans, I'm not saying he does, but he does understand evil and betrayal and selfishness, and that's something that applies to everything with a mind and a heart. He closed his mouth abruptly as if afraid that he'd said too much.
So you think that we should do as Sebastian asks, send Jason Clary to him? Asked Patrick.
No, Simon said. I think he always lies, and sending them won't help anything, even if he swears he lies, like Isabel said. He looked at Jace and then Clary.
You know, he said. You know him better than anyone. You know he never means what he says. Tell them.
Clary shook her head mutely. It was Isabel who answered for her.
They can't, she said. It would seem like they were begging for their lives, and neither of them are going to do that.
I've already volunteered, said Jace. I said I would go. You know why he wants me. He threw his arms wide. Clary wasn't surprised to see that the heavenly fire was visible against the skin of his forearms like golden wires. The heavenly fire injured him at the Burren. He's afraid of it, so he's afraid of me. I saw it on his face in Clary's room. There was a long silence. Gia slumped back in her chair.
You're right, she said. I don't disagree with any of you, but I cannot control the Clave, and there are those among them who will choose what they see as safety, and yet others who will hate the idea that we allied with Downworlders in the first place and will welcome a chance to refuse. If Sebastian wished to splinter the Clave into factions, and I'm sure he did, he chose a good way to do it.
She looked around at the Lightwoods, at Jace and Clary, the Consul's steady dark gaze resting on each of them in turn.
I would love to hear suggestions, she added a little dryly.
We could go into hiding, Isabel said immediately. Disappear to a place where Sebastian will never find us. You can report back to him that Jason Clary fled despite your attempts to keep us. He can't blame you for that.
A reasonable person wouldn't blame the Clave, said Jace. Sebastian's not reasonable.
There isn't anywhere we can hide from him, Clary said. He found me in Armitage's house. He can find me anywhere.
Maybe Magnus could have helped us, but...
There are other warlocks, said Patrick, and Clary chanced a glimpse at Alec's face. It looked like it had been carved out of stone.
You can't count on them helping us, no matter what you pay them, not now, Alec said.
That's the point of the kidnapping. They won't come to the aid of the Clave, not until they see whether we come to their aid first.
There was a knock on the door, and in came two silent brothers, their robes glimmering like parchment in the witchlight.
Brother Enoch, said Patrick by way of greeting.
And Brother Zachariah, said the second of them, drawing his hood down.
Despite what Jace had hinted at in the council room, the sight of the now-human Zachariah was a shock. He was barely recognizable, only the dark runes on the arches of his cheekbones a reminder of what he had been. He was slender, almost slight, and tall, with a delicate and very human elegance to the shape of his face and dark hair. He looked perhaps 20.
Is that... Isabel said in a low, amazed voice.
Brother Zachariah, when did he get hot?
Isabel? Clary whispered.
But Brother Zachariah either hadn't heard her or had great self-restraint. He was looking at Gia, and then, to Clary's surprise, said something in a language she didn't know. Gia's lips trembled for a moment, then they tightened into a hard line. She turned to the others.
Amalric Kriegsmesser is dead, she said.
It took Clary, numb from a dozen shocks in as many hours, several seconds to remember who that was. The Indarkand who had been captured in Berlin and brought to the Basileus while the brothers searched for a cure.
Nothing we tried on him worked, said Brother Zachariah.
His spoken voice was musical. He sounded British, Clary thought. She'd only ever heard his voice in her mind before, and telepathic communication apparently wiped out accents.
Not a single spell, not a single potion. Finally, we had him drink from the mortal cup.
It destroyed him, said Enoch.
Death was instantaneous.
Amalric's body must be sent through a portal to the warlocks in the spiral labyrinth to study, Gia said.
Perhaps if we act quickly enough, they, can learn something from his death, some clue to a cure.
His poor family, said Maris. They will not even see him burned and buried in the Silent City.
He is not Nephilim anymore, said Patrick. If he were to be buried, it would be at the crossroads outside Broslin Forest.
Like my mother was, said Jace, because she killed herself. Criminals, suicides, and monsters are buried at the place where all roads cross, right? He had his full sprite voice on, the one Clary knew covered up anger or pain. She wanted to move closer to him, but the room was too full of people.
Not always, said Brother Zachariah in his soft voice. One of the young Longfords was at the Battle of the Citadel, found himself forced to kill his own Parabato, who had been turned by Sebastian. Afterward, he turned his sword on himself and cut his wrist. He will be burned with the rest of the dead today, with all attendant honors.
Clary remembered the young man she had seen at the Citadel standing over a dead shadow hunter in red gear, weeping as the battle raged around him. She wondered if she should have stopped, spoken to him, if it would have helped, if there was anything she could have done. Jace looked as if he were going to throw up.
This is why you have to let me go after Sebastian, he said. This can't keep happening, these battles, fighting the Indarkand, he'll find worse things to do. Sebastian always does. Being turned is worse than dying.
Jace, Clary said sharply, but Jace shot her a look, half desperate and half pleading, a look that begged her not to doubt him. He leaned forward, hands on the consul's desk.
Send me to him, Jace said, and I'll try to kill him. I have the heavenly fire. It's our best chance.
It's not an issue of sending you anywhere, said Maris. We can't send you to him. We don't know where Sebastian is. It's an issue of letting him take you.
Then let him take me.
Absolutely not. Brother Zachariah looked grave, and Clary remembered what he had said to her once. If the chance comes before me to save the last of the Herondale bloodline, I consider that of higher importance than the fealty I render the Clave. Jace Herondale, he said. The Clave can choose to obey Sebastian or defy him, but either way, you cannot be given up to him in the way he will expect. We must surprise him. Otherwise, we are simply delivering to him the only weapon that we know he fears.
Do you have another suggestion? Asked Gia. Do we draw him out? Use Jace and Clary to capture him?
You can't use them as bait, Isabel protested.
Maybe we could separate him from his forces, suggested Maris.
You can't trick Sebastian, Clary said, feeling exhausted. He doesn't care about reasons or excuses. There's only him and what he wants, and if you get between those two things, he'll destroy you.
Gia leaned across the table.
Maybe we can convince him he wants something else. Is there anything else we could offer him as a bargaining chip?
No, Clary whispered. There's nothing. Sebastian is...
But how did you explain her brother?
How could you even explain staring into the dark heart of a black hole?
Imagine if you were the last shadow hunter left on Earth. Imagine if all your family and friends were dead. Imagine if there were no one left who even believed in what you were. Imagine if you were on the Earth in a billion billion years after the sun had scorched away all the life, and you were crying out from inside yourself for just one single living creature to still draw breath alongside you, but there was nothing, only rivers of fire and ashes. Imagine being that lonely, and then imagine there was only one way you could think of to fix it. Then imagine what you would do to make that thing happen.
No, he won't change his mind, not ever. A murmur of voices broke out. Gia clapped her hands for silence.
Enough, she said. We're going around in circles. It is time for the Clave and Council to discuss the situation.
If I might make a suggestion...
Brother Zachariah's eyes swept the room, thoughtful under dark lashes, before coming to rest on Gia.
The funeral rites for the Citadel dead are about to begin. You will be expected there, Consul, as will you, Inquisitor. I would suggest that Clary and Jace remain at the Inquisitor's house, considering the contention surrounding them, and that the Council gather after the rites.
We have a right to be at the meeting, said Clary. This decision concerns us. It's about us.
You will be summoned, said Gia, her gaze not resting on Clary or Jace, but skipping past them, sweeping over Robert and Maris, Brother Enoch and Zachariah. Until then, rest. You will need your energy. It could be a long night.
12.
The Formal Nightmare. The bodies were burning on orderly rows of pyres that had been set up along the road to Brosselin Forest. The sun was beginning to set behind a cloudy white sky, and as each pyre went up, it burst in orange sparks. The effect was oddly beautiful, although Gia Penhallow doubted that any of the mourners gathered on the plain thought so. For some reason, a rhyme she had learned as a child was repeating itself in her head. Black for hunting through the night, for death and mourning the colors white, gold for a bride in her wedding gown, and red to call enchantment down. White silk when our bodies burn, blue banners when the lost return, flame for the birth of a Nephilim, and to wash away our sins. Gray for knowledge best untold, bone for those who don't grow old. Saffron lights the victory march, green will mend our broken hearts, silver for the demon towers, and bronze to summon wicked powers. Bone for those who don't grow old. Brother Enoch, in his bone-colored robes, was striding up and down the line of pyres. Shadow hunters stood or knelt or cast into the orange flames handfuls of the pale white Alicante flowers that grew even in the winter.
Consul.
The voice at her shoulder was soft. She turned to see Brother Zachariah, the boy who had once been Brother Zachariah at least, standing at her shoulder.
Brother Enoch said you wished to speak to me. Brother Zachariah, she began, and then paused. Is there another name by which you wish to be called? The name you had before you became a silent brother. Zachariah will do fine for now, he said. I am not yet ready to reclaim my old name. I have heard, she said, and paused, for the next bit was awkward, that one of the warlocks of the Spiral Labyrinth, Teresa Gray, is someone whom you knew and cared for during your mortal life. And for someone who has been a silent brother as long as you have, that must be a rare thing.
She is all I have left from that time, said Zachariah. She and Magnus. I would have wished to talk to Magnus, if I could have, before he...
Would you like to go to the Spiral Labyrinth? Gia interrupted.
Zachariah looked down at her with startled eyes. He looked about the same age as her daughter, Gia thought, his lashes impossibly long, his eyes both young and old at the same time.
Are you releasing me from Alicante? Aren't all warriors needed?
You have served the clave for more than 130 years. We can ask no more of you. He looked back at the pyres, at the black smoke smearing the air.
How much does the Spiral Labyrinth know of the attacks on the Institutes, the Citadel, the representatives?
They are students of lore, said Gia, not warriors or politicians. They know of what happened at the Burren. We have discussed Sebastian's magic, possible cures for the Undarkened, ways to strengthen the wards.
They do not ask beyond that. And you do not tell, said Zachariah. So they do not know of the Citadel, the representatives.
Gia set her jaw. I suppose you will say I must tell them.
No,
he said. He had his hands in his pockets. His breath was visible on the clean, cold air.
I will not say that.
They stood side by side in the snow and silence until, to her surprise, he spoke again.
I will not go to the Spiral Labyrinth. I will stay in Idris.
But don't you want to see her?
I want to see Tessa more than I want anything else in the world, said Zachariah. But if she knew more of what was happening here, she would want to be here and fight beside us. And I find that I do not want that.
His dark hair fell forward as he shook his head.
I find that as I waken from being a silent brother, I am capable of not wanting that. Perhaps it is selfish. I am not sure. But I am sure that the warlocks in the Spiral Labyrinth are safe. Tessa is safe. If I go to her, I will be safe as well. But I will also be hiding. I am not a warlock. I cannot be a help to the Labyrinth. I can be a help here.
You could go to the Labyrinth and return. It would be complicated, but I could request.
No, he said quietly. I cannot see Tessa face to face and keep from telling her the truth about what is happening here. And more than that, I cannot go to Tessa and present myself to her as a mortal man, as a shadow hunter, and not tell her the feelings I had for her when I was... He broke off. That my feelings are unchanged. I cannot offer her that, and then return to a place where I might be killed. Better she thinks than ever was a chance for us. Better you think it as well, said Gia, looking at his face, at the hope and longing that was painted there clearly for anyone to see. She looked over at Robert and Maris Lightwood, standing a distance apart from each other in the snow. Not far away was her own daughter, Aline, leaning her head against Helen Blackthorne's curly blonde one. We shadow hunters, we put ourselves in danger every hour, every day. I think sometimes we are reckless with our hearts, the way we are with our lives. When we give them away, we give every piece. And if we do not get what we so desperately need, how do we live? You think she might not still love me, said Zachariah. After all this time. Gia said nothing. It was, after all, exactly what she thought. It is a reasonable question, he said. And perhaps she does not. As long as she is alive and well and happy in this world, I will find a way to be happy as well, even if it is not beside her. He looked over at the pyres, at the lengthening shadows of the dead. Which body is that of young Longford, the one who killed his Parabatai? There, Gia pointed. Why do you want to know? It is the worst thing I can ever imagine having to do. I would not have been brave enough. Since there is someone who was, I wish to pay my respects to him, said Zachariah. And he walked away across the snow-dusted ground toward the fires.
The funeral's over, Isabel said, or at least the smoke stopped rising. She was perched on the windowsill of her room in the Inquisitor's house. The room was small and white-painted, with flowered curtains. Not very Isabel, Clary thought, but then it would have been hard to replicate Isabel's powder and glitter-strewn room in New York on short notice. I was reading my codex the other day. Clary finished buttoning up the wool cardigan she'd changed into. She couldn't stand to keep on for one more second the sweater she'd been wearing all day yesterday had slept in and that Sebastian had touched. And I was thinking, mundanes kill one another all the time. They have wars, all kinds of wars, and slaughter one another, but this is the first time Nephilim have ever had to kill other shadow hunters. When Jason and I were trying to convince Robert to let us go through to the Citadel, I couldn't understand why he was being so stubborn, but I think I kind of get it now. I think he couldn't believe that shadow hunters could really pose a threat to other shadow hunters, no matter what we told them about the Baron. Isabel laughed shortly. That's charitable of you. She pulled her knees up to her chest. You know, your mum took me to the Adamant Citadel with her. They said I would have made a good Iron Sister. I saw them at the battle, said Clary. The sisters, they were beautiful and scary, like looking at fire. But they can't get married. They can't be with anyone. They live forever, but they don't have lives. Isabel rested her chin on her knees. There's all different ways of living, said Clary. And look at Brother Zachariah. Isabel glanced up. I heard my parents talking about him on the way to the council meeting today, she said. They said what happened to him was a miracle. I've never heard of anyone ending being a silent brother before. I mean, they can die, but reversing the spells, it shouldn't be possible. A lot of things shouldn't be possible, Clary said, raking her fingers through her hair. She wanted a shower, but she couldn't bear the thought of standing there alone under the water, thinking about her mother, about Luke. The idea of losing either of them, never mind both of them, was as terrifying as the idea of being abandoned out at sea. A tiny speck of humanity surrounded by miles of water around and below, the empty sky above. Nothing to moor her to earth. Mechanically, she started to divide her hair into two braids. A second later, Isabel had appeared behind her in the mirror. Let me do that, she said gruffly, and took hold of the strands of Clary's hair. Her fingers worked the curls expertly.
Clary closed her eyes and let herself be lost for a moment in the sensation of someone else taking care of her. When she had been a little girl, her mother had braided her hair every morning before Simon had come to pick her up for school. She remembered his habit of undoing the ribbons while she was drawing and hiding them in places, her pockets, her backpack, waiting for her to notice and throw a pencil at him. It was impossible, sometimes, to believe that her life had once been so ordinary. "Hey," Isabel said, nudging her. "You okay?" "I'm fine," Clary said. "I'm fine. Everything's fine." "Clary," she felt Isabel's hand on her hand, slowly unclosing Clary's fingers. Her hand was wet. Clary realized that she had been gripping one of Isabel's hairpins so tightly that the ends had dug into her palm and blood was running down her wrist. I don't even remember picking that up," she said numbly. "I'll take it." Isabel pulled it away. "You're not fine." "I have to be fine," Clary said. "I have to be. I have to stay in control and not fall apart for my mom and for Luke." Isabel made a gentle, non-committal noise. Clary was aware that the other girl's steely was sweeping over the back of her hand and the flow of blood was slowing. She still felt no pain. There was only the darkness at the end of her vision, the darkness that threatened to close in every time she thought of her parents. She felt like she was drowning, kicking at the edges of her own consciousness to keep herself alert and above the water. Isabel suddenly gasped and jumped back. "What is it?" Clary asked. "I saw a face at the window." Clary seized Heosphorus from her belt and started to make her way across the room. Isabel was right behind her, her silver-gold whip uncurling from her hand. It slashed forward, the tip curled around the handle of the window and yanked it open. There was a yelp, and a small, shadowy figure fell forward onto the rug, landing on hands and knees. Isabel's whip snapped back into her grasp as she stared, wearing a rare look of astonishment. The shadow on the floor uncurled, revealing a diminutive figure clad in black, the smudge of a pale face and a tousle of long blonde hair coming free from a careless braid. "Emma?" Clary said. The southwest part of the long meadow in Prospect Park was deserted at night. The moon, half full, shone down on the distant view of Brooklyn brownstones beyond the park, the outline of bare trees and the space that had been cleared on the dry winter grass by the pack. It was a circle, roughly 20 feet across, hemmed in by standing werewolves. The whole of the downtown New York pack was there, 30 or 40 wolves, young and old. Leela, her dark hair bound back in a ponytail, stalked to the center of the circle and clapped once for attention. "Members of the pack," she said, "a challenge has been issued. Rufus Hastings has challenged Bartholomew Velasquez for the seniority and leadership of the New York pack." There was a muttering in the crowd. Leela raised her voice. "This is an issue of temporary leadership in the absence of Luke Garraway. No discussion of replacing Luke as leader will be had at this time." She clasped her hands behind her back. "Please step forward, Bartholomew and Rufus." Bat stepped forward into the circle, and a moment later Rufus followed. Both were dressed unseasonably in jeans, t-shirt, and boots, their arms bare despite the chill air. "The rules of the challenge are these," said Leela. "Wolf must fight wolf without weapons save the weapons of tooth and claw. Because it is a challenge for leadership, the fight will be a fight to the death, not to the blood. Whoever lives will be leader, and all other wolves will swear loyalty to him tonight. Do you understand?" Bat nodded. He looked tense, his jaw set. Rufus was grinning all over, his arms swinging at his sides. He waved away Leela's words.
"We all know how it works, kid."
Her lips compressed into a thin line. "Then you may begin," she said, though as she moved back into the circle with the others, she muttered, "Good luck, Bat," under her breath, just loudly enough for everyone to hear her. Rufus didn't seem bothered. He was still grinning, and the moment Leela stepped back into the circle with the pack, he lunged. Bat sidestepped him. Rufus was big and heavy. Bat was lighter and a shade faster. He spun sideways, just missing Rufus's claws, and came back with an uppercut that snapped Rufus's head back. He pressed his advantage quickly, raining down blows that sent the other wolf stumbling back. Rufus's feet dragged along the ground as a low growl began in the depths of his throat. His hands hung at his sides, his fingers clenched in. Bat swung again, landing a punch to Rufus's shoulder.
Just as Rufus turned and slashed out with his left hand, his claws were fully extended, massive and gleaming in the moonlight. It was clear he had sharpened them somehow. Each one was like a razor, and they raked across Bat's chest, slicing open his shirt and his skin with it. Scarlet bloomed across Bat's ribcage. "First blood," Leela called, and the wolves began to stamp slowly, each raising their left foot and bringing it down in a regular beat so that the ground seemed to echo like a drum. Rufus grinned again and advanced on Bat. Bat swung and hit him, landing another punch to the jaw that brought blood to Rufus's mouth. Rufus turned his head to the side and spit red onto the grass, and kept coming. Bat backed up, his claws were out now, his eyes gone flat and yellow. He growled and flung out a kick. Rufus grabbed his leg and twisted, sending Bat to the ground. He flung himself after Bat, but the other werewolf had already rolled away, and Rufus landed on the ground in a crouch. Bat staggered to his feet, but it was clear that he was losing blood. Blood had rolled down his chest and was soaking the waistband of his jeans, and his hands were wet with it. He slashed out with his claws. Rufus turned, taking the blow on his shoulder, four shallow cuts. With a snarl, he seized Bat's wrist and twisted. The sound of snapping bone was loud, and Bat gasped and pulled back. Rufus lunged. The weight of him bore Bat to the ground, slamming Bat's head hard against a tree root. Bat went limp. The other wolves were still pounding the earth with their feet. Some of them were openly weeping, but none moved forward as Rufus sat up on Bat, one hand pressing him flat to the grass, the other raised, the razors of his fingers gleaming. He moved in for the killing blow. "Stop!" Maya's voice rang out through the park. The other wolves looked up in shock. Rufus grinned. "Hey, little girl," he said. Maya didn't move. She was in the middle of the circle. Somehow, she had pushed past the line of wolves without them noticing. She wore cords and a denim jacket, her hair pulled tightly back. Her expression was severe, almost blank. "I want to issue a challenge," she said. "Maya," Leela said, "you know the law. When you fight with a wolf of the pack, you must fight him alone and afar. Lest others take part in the quarrel and the pack be diminished by war, you cannot interrupt the battle." "Rufus is about to deliver the death blow," Maya said unemotionally. "Do you really feel like I need to wait that 5 minutes before I issue my challenge? I will if Rufus is too scared to fight me with Bat still breathing." Rufus leaped off Bat's limp body with a roar and advanced on Maya. Leela's voice rose in panic. "Maya, get out of there. Once there's first blood, we can't stop the fight." Rufus lunged at Maya. His claws tore the edge of her jacket. Maya dropped to her knees and rolled, then came up onto her knees, her claws extended. Her heart was slamming against her ribcage, sending wave after wave of icy, hot blood through her veins. She could feel the sting of the cut on her shoulder. First blood. The werewolves began to stamp the earth again, though this time they weren't silent. There was muttering and gasping in the ranks. Maya did her best to block it out, ignore it. She saw Rufus step toward her. He was a shadow, outlined by moonlight. And in that moment, she saw not just him, but also Sebastian, looming over her on the beach, a cold prince carved out of ice and blood. "Your boyfriend's dead." Her fist clenched against the ground as Rufus threw himself at her, razor claws extended. She rose and flung her handful of dirt and grass into his face. He staggered back, choking and blinded. Maya stepped forward and slammed her boot down on his foot. She felt the small bone shatter, heard him scream. In that moment, when he was distracted, she jammed her claws into his eyes. A scream ripped from his throat, quickly cut off. He slumped backwards, collapsing onto the grass with a loud crash that made her think of a tree falling. She looked down at her hand. It was covered in blood and smears of liquid, brain matter and vitreous humor. She dropped to her knees and threw up in the grass. Her claws slid back in and she wiped her hands on the ground, over and over as her stomach spasmed. She felt a hand on her back and looked up to see Leela leaning over her. "Maya," she said softly, but her voice was drowned out by the pack chanting the name of their new leader. "Maya, Maya, Maya!" Leela's eyes were dark and concerned. Maya rose to her feet, wiping her mouth on the sleeve of her jacket, and hurried across the grass to Bat. She bent down beside him and touched her hand to his cheek. "Bat?" she said. With an effort, he opened his eyes. There was blood on his mouth, but he was breathing steadily. Maya guessed he was already healing from Rufus's blows.
I didn't know you fought dirty, he said with a half-smile.
Maya thought of Sebastian and his glittering grin and the bodies on the beach. She thought of what Lily had told her. She thought of the shadow hunters behind their wards and of the fragility of the Accords and Council.
It's going to be a dirty war, she thought, but that wasn't what she said out loud.
I didn't know your name was Bartholomew. She picked up his hand, held it in her own bloody one. All around them, the pack was still chanting, Maya, Maya, Maya. He closed his eyes.
Everyone's got their secrets.
It almost doesn't seem to make a difference, said Jace, curled into the window seat in his and Alec's attic room.
It all feels like prison.
Do you think that's a side effect of the fact that armed guards are standing all around the house? Simon suggested. I mean, just a thought. Jace shot him an irritable look.
What is it about mundanes and their overwhelming compulsion to state the obvious? He asked.
He leaned forward, staring through the panes of the window. Simon might have been exaggerating slightly, but only slightly. The dark figures standing at cardinal points surrounding the Inquisitor's house might have been invisible to the untrained eye, but not to Jace's.
I'm not a mundane, Simon said, an edge to his voice.
And what is it about shadow hunters and their overwhelming compulsion to get themselves and everyone they care about killed?
Stop arguing!
Alec had been leaning against the wall, in classical thinking pose, with his chin propped on his hand. The guards are there to protect us, not keep us in. Have some perspective.
Alec, you've known me for several years, said Jace. When have I ever had perspective?
Alec glowered at him.
Are you still mad because I broke your phone? Jay said. Because you broke my wrist, so I'd say we're even.
It was sprained, Alec said. Not broken, sprained.
Now who's arguing? Said Simon.
Don't talk, Alec gestured at him with an expression of vague disgust. Every time I look at you, I keep remembering coming in here and seeing you draped all over my sister. Jay sat up.
I didn't hear about this.
Oh, come on, said Simon.
Simon, you're blushing, observed Jace. And you're a vampire and almost never blush, so this better be really juicy and weird. Were bicycles involved in some kinky way, vacuum cleaners, umbrellas?
Big umbrellas or the little kind you get with drinks, Alec asked.
Does it matter?
Jace began, and then broke off as Clary came into the room with Isabel, holding a small girl by the hand. After a moment of shocked silence, Jace recognized her. Emma, the girl whom Clary had run off to comfort during the council meeting. The one who'd looked at him with barely concealed hero worship. Not that he minded hero worship, but it was a bit odd to have a child dropped suddenly in the middle of what had admittedly begun to be a somewhat awkward conversation.
Clary, he said, did you kidnap Emma Carstairs?
Clary gave him an exasperated look.
No, she got here on her own.
I came in through one of the windows, Emma supplied helpfully, like in Peter Pan. Alec started to protest. Clary held her free hand up to stop him. Her other hand was now on Emma's shoulder.
Everyone just be quiet for a second, okay?
Clary said. She's not supposed to be here, yeah, but she came for a reason. She has information.
That's right, Emma said in her small, determined voice. She was actually only about a head shorter than Clary, but then Clary was tiny.
Emma would probably be tall one day. Jace tried to remember her father, John Carstairs. He was sure he'd seen him at council meetings, and thought he recalled a tall, fair-haired man. Or had his hair been dark? The Blackthorns he remembered, of course, but the Carstairs had faded out of his memory. Clary returned his sharp look with one that said, "Be nice." Jace closed his mouth. He'd never given much thought to whether he liked children or not, though he'd always liked playing with Max. Max had been surprisingly adept at strategy for such a little boy, and Jace had always liked setting him puzzles. The fact that Max had worshipped the ground he walked on hadn't hurt either. Jace thought of the wooden soldier he'd given to Max and closed his eyes in sudden pain. When he opened them again, Emma was looking at him. Not in the way she'd looked at him when he found her with Clary and the guard, the sort of startled, half-impressed, half-frightened, "You're Jace Lightwood" look, but with a little bit of worry. In fact, her whole posture was a mix of confidence that he was fairly sure she was faking, and clear fright. Her parents were dead, he thought, had died days ago.
and he remembered a time 7 years before when he'd faced the Lightwoods himself with the knowledge in his heart that his father had just died and the bitter tang of the word orphan in his ears.
Emma, he said as gently as he could, how did you get into the window?
I climbed over the rooftops, she said, pointing out the window. It wasn't that hard. Dormer windows are almost always bedrooms, so I climbed down to the first one, and it was Clary's. She shrugged, as if what she'd done hadn't been either risky or impressive. It was mine, actually, said Isabel, who was looking at Emma as if she were a fascinating specimen. Isabel sat down on the trunk at the foot of Alec's bed, stretching out her long legs. Clary lives over at Luke's. Emma looked confused. I don't know where that is, and everyone was talking about all of you being here, that's why I came. Alec looked down at Emma with the half-fond, half-worried look of a much older brother. Don't be afraid, he began. I'm not afraid, she snapped. I came here because you need help. Jace felt his mouth quirk up involuntarily at the corner. What kind of help? He asked. I recognized that man today, she said. The one who threatened the consul? He came with Sebastian to attack the Institute, she swallowed. That place he said we would all burn in? Edom... It's another word for hell, said Alec. Not a real place, you don't have to be worried. She's not worried, Alec, Clary said. Just listen. It is a place, said Emma. When they attacked the Institute, I heard them. I heard one of them say that they could take Mark to Edom and sacrifice him there. And when we escaped through the portal, I heard her calling after us that we'd burn in Edom, that there was no real escape. Her voice shook. The way they talked about Edom, I know it was a real place, or a real place to them. Edom, said Clary, remembering. Valentine called Lilith something like that. He called her My Lady of Edom. Alec's eyes met Jace's. Alec nodded and slipped out of the room. Jace felt his shoulders relax minutely. In among the clamor of everything, it was good to have a Parabatai who knew what you were thinking without you having to say it. Have you told anyone else about this? Emma hesitated and then shook her head. Why not? Said Simon, who had been quiet until that moment. Emma looked at him, blinking. She was only 12, Jace thought, and had probably barely encountered downworlders up close before. Why not tell the Clave? Because I don't trust the Clave, said Emma in a small voice. But I trust you. Clary swallowed visibly. Emma, when we got here, the Clave questioned all of us, especially Jules, and they used the mortal sword to make sure we weren't lying. It hurts, but they didn't care. They used it on Ty and Livy. They used it on Drew. Emma sounded outraged. They would probably have used it on Tavi if he could talk, and it hurts. The mortal sword hurts. I know, Clary said quietly. We've been staying with the Penhallows, Emma said, because of Aline and Helen, and because the Clave wants to keep an eye on us, too, because of what we saw. I was downstairs when they came back from the funeral and I heard them talking, so I hid. A whole group of them, not just Patrick and Gia, but a lot of other Institute heads, too. They were talking about what they should do, what the Clave should do, whether they should turn over Jason Clary to Sebastian as if it were their choice, their decision. But I thought it should be your decision. Some of them said it didn't matter whether you wanted to go or not. Simon was on his feet. But Jason Clary offered to go, practically begged to go. We would have told them the truth. Emma pushed her tangled hair out of her face. Her eyes were enormous, brown, shot through with bits of gold and amber. They didn't have to use the mortal sword on us. We would have told the council the truth, but they used it anyway. They used it on Jules until his hands were burned from it. Her voice shook. So I thought you should know what they were saying. They don't want you to know it's not your choice because they know Clary can make portals. They know she can get out of here, and if she escapes, they think they'll have no way to bargain with Sebastian. The door opened, and Alec came back into the room, carrying a book bound in brown leather. He was holding it in such a way as to obscure the title, but his eyes met Jace's, and he gave a slight nod, and then a glance towards Emma. Jace's heartbeat sped up. Alec had found something. Something he didn't like, judging from his grim expression. But something nonetheless.
Did the Clave members you overheard give any sense when they were going to decide what to do? Jace asked Emma, partly to distract her, as Alex sat down on the bed, sliding the book behind him. Emma shook her head. They were still arguing when I left. I crawled out the top floor window. Jules told me not to because I'd get killed, but I knew I wouldn't. I'm a good climber, she added with a tinge of pride. And he worries too much. It's good to have people worry about you, said Alec. It means they care. It's how you know they're good friends. Emma's gaze went from Alec to Jace, curious. Do you worry about him? She asked Alec, surprising a laugh out of him. All the time, he said. Jace could get himself killed putting his pants on in the morning. Being his parabatai is a full-time job. I wish I had a parabatai, Emma said. It's like someone who's your family, but because they want to be, not because they have to be. She flushed, suddenly self-conscious. Anyway, I don't think anyone should be punished for saving people. Is that why you trust us? Clary asked, touched. You think we save people? Emma toed the carpet with her boots, then she looked up. I knew about you, she said to Jace, blushing. I mean, everyone knows about you. That you were Valentine's son, but then you weren't, you were Jonathan Herondale? And I don't think that meant anything to most people, most of them called you Jace Lightwood. But it made a difference to my dad. I heard him say to my mom that he thought the Herondales were all gone, that the family was dead, but you were the last of them, and he voted in the council meeting for the Clave to keep looking for you, because he said, the Carstairs owe the Herondales. Why? Alec said. What do they owe them for? I don't know, Emma said. But I came because my dad would have wanted me to, even if it was dangerous. Jace huffed a soft laugh. Something tells me you don't care if things are dangerous. He crouched down, putting his eyes on a level with Emma's. Is there anything you can tell us, anything else they said? She shook her head. They don't know where Sebastian is. They don't know about the Edom thing. I mentioned it when I was holding the mortal sword, but I think they just thought it was another word for hell. They never asked me if I thought it was a real place, so I didn't say. Thanks for telling us. It's a help, a huge help. You should go, he added as gently as he could, before they notice you're gone. But from now on, the Herondales owe the Carstairs, okay? Remember that. Jace stood up as Emma turned to Clary, who nodded and led her over to the window where Jace had been sitting earlier. Clary bent down and hugged the younger girl before reaching over to unlatch a window. Emma clambered out with the agility of a monkey. She swung herself up until only her dangling boots were visible, and a moment later those were gone too. Jace heard a light scraping overhead as she darted across the roof tiles, and then silence. I like her, Isabel said finally. She kind of reminds me of Jace when he was little and stubborn and acted like he was immortal. Two of those things still apply, said Clary, swinging the window shut. She sat down on the window seat. I guess the big question is, do we tell Gia or anyone else on the council what Emma told us? That depends, said Jace. Gia has to bow to what the whole Clave wants. She said so herself. If they decide that what they want is to toss us into a cage until Sebastian comes for us, well, that pretty much squanders any upper hand this information might give us. So it depends on if the information's actually useful or not, said Simon. Right, said Jace. Alec, what did you find out? Alec pulled the book out from behind him. It was an Encyclopedia Demonica, the sort of book every Shadowhunter library would have. I thought Edom might be a name for one of the demon realms. Well, everyone's been theorizing that Sebastian might be in a different dimension since he's untrackable, said Isabel. But the demon dimensions, there are millions of them, and people can't just go there. Some are better known than others, said Alec. The Bible and the Enochian texts mention quite a few, disguised and subsumed, of course, into the stories and myths. Edom is mentioned as a wasteland, he read out loud, his voice measured. And the streams of Edom shall be turned into pitch, and her soil into sulfur. Her land shall become burning pitch. Night and day it shall not be quenched. Its smoke shall go up forever. From generation to generation it shall lie waste. None shall pass through it forever and ever, he sighed. And of course there's the legends about Lilith and Edom, that she was banished there, that she rules the place with the demon Asmodeus.
That's probably why the Indarkand were talking about sacrificing Mark Blackthorn to her in Eden.
Lilith protects Sebastian, said Clary. If he was going to go to a demon realm, he'd go to hers.
None shall pass through it forever and ever doesn't sound very encouraging, said Jace. Besides, there's no way to get to the demon realms. Traveling from place to place in this world is one thing.
Well, there is a way, I think, said Alec. A pathway that the Nephilim can't close because it lies outside the jurisdiction of our laws. It's old, older than Shadowhunters, old, wild magic. He sighed. It's in the Seelie Court, and it's guarded by the Fair Folk. No human has set foot on that pathway in more than 100 years.
13. Paved with good intentions. Jace was prowling the room like a cat. The others watched him, Simon with one eyebrow cocked.
There's no other way to get there, Jace asked. We can't try to portal.
We're not demons.
We can portal only within a dimension, said Alec.
I know that, but if Clary experimented with the portal runes... I won't do it, Clary interrupted, putting her hand protectively over the pocket where her steely rested. I won't put you all in danger. I portaled myself and Luke to Idris and nearly got us killed. I'm not risking it.
Jace was still prowling. It was what he did when he was thinking. Clary knew that, but looked at him worriedly all the same. He was closing and unclosing his hands and murmuring under his breath. Finally, he stopped.
Clary, he said. You can make a portal to the Seelie Court, right?
Yes, she said. That I can do. I've been there, I remember it, but
would we be safe? We haven't been invited, and the Fair Folk don't like incursions into their territory.
There's no we, Jace said. None of you are coming. I'm going to do this alone.
Alec sprang to his feet. I knew it. I bloody knew it, and absolutely not. Not a chance.
Jace cocked an eyebrow at him. He was outwardly calm. But Clary could see his tension in the set of his shoulders and the way he rocked forward slightly on the balls of his feet.
Since when do you say bloody?
Since the situation bloody warrants it, Alec crossed his arms over his chest. And I thought we were going to discuss telling the Clave.
We can't do that, Jace said. Not if we're going to get to the demon's realms through the Seelie Court. It's not like half the Clave can just pour into the court. That would seem like an act of war against the Fair Folk.
Whereas if it's just 5 of us, we can sweet-talk them into letting us through? Isabel raised an eyebrow.
We've parleyed with the Queen before, Jace said. You went to the Queen when when Sebastian had me.
And she tricked us into taking walkie-talkie rings she could listen in on, Simon said. I wouldn't trust her further than I could throw a medium-sized elephant.
I didn't say anything about trusting her. She'll do whatever's in her interest at the moment. We just have to make it her interest to let us have access to the road to Edom.
We're still Shadowhunters, said Alec. Still representatives of the Clave. Whatever we do in Faerie, they'll answer for it.
So we'll use tact and cleverness, said Jace. Look, I'd love to make the Clave deal with the Queen and her court for us, but we don't have the time. They, Luke and Jocelyn and Magnus and Raphael, don't have the time. Sebastian's gearing up, he's speeding up his plans, his bloodlust. You don't know what he's like when he gets like this, but I do.
He caught his breath. There was a thin sheen of sweat across his cheekbones.
Which is why I want to do this alone. Brother Zachariah said it to me, I am the heavenly fire. It's not like we can get another glorious, we can't exactly summon another angel, we played that card.
Fine, Clary said. But even if you're the only source of heavenly fire, that doesn't mean you need to do this alone.
She's right, Alec said. We know that heavenly fire can hurt Sebastian, but we don't know it's the only thing that can hurt him.
And it definitely doesn't mean you're the only one who can kill however many Indarkand Sebastian has standing around him, Clary pointed out. Or that you can get yourself through the Seelie Court safely on your own, or, after that, through some forsaken demon realm where you have to find Sebastian.
We can't track him because we're not in the same dimension, Jace said. He held up his wrist where Sebastian's silver bracelet glittered. Once I'm in his world, I can track him. I've done it before.
We can track him, Clary said.
Jace, there's more to this than just finding him. This is huge, bigger than anything we've done. This isn't just about killing Sebastian. This is about the prisoners. It's a rescue mission. It's their lives on the line as well as ours. Her voice cracked. Jace had paused his prowling. He looked from one of his friends to the other, almost pleading. I don't want anything to happen to you. Yeah, well, none of us want anything to happen to us either, said Simon. But think ahead, what happens if you go and we stay? Sebastian wants Clary, wants her more than he wants you, and he can find her here in Alicante. Nothing's stopping him from coming again except a promise that he'll wait 2 days. And what are his promises worth? He could come for any of us at any time. He proved that with the Downworld representatives. We're sitting ducks here, better to go where he isn't expecting or looking for us. I will not hang back here in Alicante while Magnus is in danger, said Alec in a surprisingly cold adult voice. Go without me, and you disrespect our Parabatai oaths, you disrespect me as a shadow hunter, and you disrespect the fact that this is my battle too. Jace looked shocked. Alec, I would never disrespect our oaths. You're one of the best shadow hunters I know. Which is why we come with you, said Isabel. You need us. You need Alec and me to back you up the way we always have. You need Clary's rune powers and Simon's vampire strength. This isn't just your fight. If you respect us as shadow hunters and as your friends, all of us, then we go with you. It's that simple. I know, Jace said softly. I know I need you. He looked over at Clary, and she heard Isabel's voice saying, You need Clary's rune powers, and remembered the first time she had ever seen him, Alec and Isabel on either side of him, and how she had thought he looked dangerous. It never occurred to her that she was like him, that she was dangerous too. Thank you, he said, and cleared his throat. Okay, everyone get into gear and pack bags. Pack for overland travel, water, what food you can grab, extra steelies, blankets. And you, he said to Simon. You might not need food, but if you have bottled blood, bring it. There might not be anything you can eat where we're going. There's always the four of you, Simon said, but he smiled a little, and Clary knew it was because Jace had included him among their number without a moment's hesitation. Finally, Jace had accepted that where they went, Simon went too, whether he was a shadow hunter or not. All right, Alec said. Everyone meet back here in 10 minutes. Clary, get ready to create a portal. And Jace? Yes? You'd better have a strategy for what we're going to do when we get to the fairy court, because we're going to need it. The maelstrom inside the portal was almost a relief. Clary went last through the shining doorway, after the other four had stepped through, and she let the cold darkness take her like water pulling her down and under, stealing the breath from her lungs, making her forget everything but the clamor and the falling. It was over too fast, the grip of the portal releasing her to fall awkwardly, her backpack twisted underneath her on the packed dirt floor of a tunnel. She caught her breath and rolled over, using a long dangling root to pull herself upright. Alec, Isabel, Jace, and Simon were picking themselves up around her, brushing off their clothes. It wasn't dirt they had fallen on, she realized, but a carpet of moss. More moss spread along the smooth brown tunnel walls, but it glowed with phosphorescent light. Small glowing flowers, like electric daisies, grew in among the moss, starring the green with white. Snaky roots dangled down from the roof of the tunnel, making Clary wonder what exactly was growing above ground. Various smaller tunnels branched off the main one, some of them too small to admit a human form. Isabel picked a piece of moss out of her hair and frowned. Where are we exactly? I aimed for just outside the throne room, Clary said. We've been here, it just always looks different. Jace had already moved down the main corridor. Even without the soundless rune, he was as quiet as a cat on the soft moss. The others followed, Clary with her hand on the hilt of her sword. She was a little surprised at how short a time it had taken to become used to a weapon hovering at her side. If she reached for Heosphorus and found it not there, she thought, she would panic. Here, Jace said softly, motioning the rest of them to be quiet. They were in an archway, a curtain separating them from a larger room beyond. The last time Clary had been here, the curtains had been made out of living butterflies, and their struggles had made it rustle. Today it was thorns, like the thorns that surrounded Sleeping Beauty's castle, thorns woven into one another so that they formed a dangling sheet. Clary could catch only glimpses of the room beyond, a glimmer of white and silver, but they could all hear the sound of laughing voices coming from the corridors around them. Glamour runes didn't work on the fair folk. There was no way to hide from the view. Jace was alert, his whole body tight. He carefully raised a dagger and parted the sheet of thorns as silently as he could. They all leaned in, staring. The room beyond was a winter fairyland, the kind Clary had rarely seen except in visits to Luke's farmhouse. The walls were sheets of white crystal, and the queen reclined upon her divan, which was white crystal to match, shot through with veins of silver in the rock. The floor was covered in snow, and long icicles hung from the ceiling, each one bound around with ropes of gold and silver thorns. Bunches of white roses were piled around the room, scattered at the foot of the queen's divan, wound through her red hair like a crown. Her dress was white and silver too, as diaphanous as a sheet of ice. One could glimpse her body through it, though not clearly. Ice and roses and the queen. The effect was blinding. She was leaning back on her couch, her head tipped up, speaking to a heavily armored fairy knight. His armor was dark brown, the color of the trunk of a tree. One of his eyes was black, the other pale blue, almost white. For a moment, Clary thought he had the head of a deer tucked under his big arm, but as she looked closer, she realized it was a helmet, decorated with antlers.
"And how goes it with the wild hunt, Gwyn?" the queen was asking. "The gatherers of the dead? I assume there were rich pickings for you at the Adamant Citadel the other night. I hear that the howls of the Nephilim tore the sky as they died."
Clary felt the shadow hunters around her tense. She remembered lying beside Jace in a boat in Venice and watching the wild hunt go by overhead. A maelstrom of shouts and battle cries, horses whose hooves gleamed scarlet, hammering across the sky.
"So I have heard, my lady," Gwyn said in a voice so hoarse it was barely understandable. It sounded like the scrape of a blade against rough bark.
"The wild hunt comes when the ravens of the battlefield scream for blood. We gather our riders from among the dying. But we were not at the Adamant Citadel. The war games of Nephilim and Dark Ones are too rich for our blood. The fair folk mix poorly with demons and angels."
"You disappoint me, Gwyn," said the queen, pouting. "This is a time of power for the fair folk. We gain, we rise, we achieve the world. We belong on the chessboards of power as much as Nephilim do. I had hoped for your advice."
"Forgive me, lady," said Gwyn. "Chess is too delicate a game for us. I cannot advise you."
"But I gave you such a gift," the queen sulked. "The Blackthorn boy, shadow hunter and fairy blood together, it is rare. He will ride at your back and demons will fear you. A gift from myself and from Sebastian."
"Sebastian," she said it comfortably, familiarly. There was a fondness in her voice, if the Queen of Fairies could be said to be fond. Clary could hear Jace's breathing beside her, sharp and quick. The others were tense as well, panic chasing realization across their faces as the Queen's words sank in. Clary felt Hios Forest grow cold in the grip of her hand. A path to the demon realms that leads through fairy lands, the earth cracking open under Sebastian's feet, Sebastian bragging that he had allies. The queen and Sebastian giving the gift of a captured Nephilim child, together.
"Demons already fear me, beautiful one," said Gwyn, and he smiled.
"My beautiful one."
The blood in Clary's veins was an icy river, singing down into her heart. Glancing down, she saw Simon move to cover Isabel's hand with his, a quick, reassuring gesture. Isabel had gone white and looked sick, as did Alec and Jace. Simon swallowed, the gold ring on his finger glittered, and she heard Sebastian's voice in her head.
"Do you really think she'd let you get your hands on something that would let you communicate with your little friends without her being able to listen in? Since I took it from you, I've spoken to her. She's spoken to me. You were a fool to trust her little sister. She likes to be on the winning side of things, the Seelie Queen. And that side will be ours, Clary. Ours."
"You owe me one favor then, Gwyn, in exchange for the boy," said the queen. "I know that the wild hunt serves its own laws,
but I would request your presence at the next battle. Gwyn frowned.
I am not sure one boy is worth such a weighty promise. As I have said, the hunt has small desire to involve itself in the business of the Nephilim.
You need not fight, said the queen, in a voice like silk. I would ask only your assistance with the bodies afterward. And there will be bodies. The Nephilim will pay for their crimes, Gwyn. Everyone must pay.
Before Gwyn could reply, another figure strode into the room from the dark tunnel that curved away behind the queen's throne. It was Melion, in his white armor, his black hair in a braid down his back. His boots were encrusted with what looked like blackish tar. He frowned when he saw Gwyn. A hunter never brings good tidings, he said.
Subside, Melion, said the queen. Gwyn and I were only discussing an exchange of favors.
Melion inclined his head.
I bear news, my lady, but I would have counsel with you in private.
She turned to Gwyn.
Are we agreed?
Gwyn hesitated, then nodded curtly, and with a glance of dislike in Melion's direction, disappeared down the dark tunnel from which the fairy knight had come. The queen slid down in her divan, her pale fingers like marble against her gown.
Very well, Melion. What do you wish to speak of? Is it news of the Downworld prisoners?
The Downworld prisoners. Clary heard Alec's sharp intake of breath behind her, and Melion's head whipped to the side. She saw his eyes narrow.
If I do not mistake myself, he said, reaching for the blade at his side. My lady, we have visitors.
Jace was already sliding his hand down his side, whispering,
Gabriel.
The seraph blade blazed up, and Isabel leapt to her feet, sweeping her whip forward, slicing through the curtain of thorns, which collapsed, rattling to the ground. Jace darted past the thorns and advanced into the throne room, Gabriel blazing in his hand. Clary whipped her sword free. They poured into the room, arranging themselves in an arc behind Jace. Alec with his bow already strung, Isabel with her whip out and glittering. Clary with her sword and Simon. Simon had no better weapon than his own self, but he stood and smiled at Melion, and his teeth glittered. The queen drew herself upright with a hiss, quickly covered. It was the only time Clary had seen her flustered.
How dare you enter the court unbidden, she demanded. This is the highest of crimes, a breaking of covenant law.
How dare you speak of breaking covenant law, Jay shouted, and the seraph blade burned in his hand. Clary thought Jonathan Shadowhunter must have looked like that so many centuries ago when he drove the demons back and saved an unknowing world from destruction. You who have murdered and lied and taken Downworlders of the Council prisoner. You have allied yourself with evil forces and you will pay for it.
The Queen of the Seely Court does not pay, said the Queen.
Everyone pays, Jay said, and suddenly he was standing on the divan, over the Queen, and the tip of his blade was against her throat. She flinched back, but she was pinned in place. Jay standing over her, his feet braced on the couch. How did you do it? He demanded. Melion swore that you were on the side of the Nephilim. Fairies can't lie. That's why the council trusted you.
Melion is half fairy. He can lie, said the queen, shooting an amused glance at Isabel, who looked shocked.
Only the queen could look amused with a blade to her throat, Clary thought.
Sometimes the simplest answer is the correct one, Shadowhunter.
That's why you wanted him on the council, said Clary, remembering the favor the queen had asked of her what seemed so long ago now. Because he can lie. A betrayal long planned. Jace was breathing hard. I should cut your throat right now.
You would not dare, said the queen, unmoving, the point of the sword against her throat. If you touch the queen of the Seely Court, the fair folk will be ranged against you for all time.
Jace was breathing hard as he spoke. His face was full of burning light. Then what are you now? He demanded. We heard you. You spoke of Sebastian as an ally. The Adamant Citadel lies on ley lines. Ley lines are the province of the Fae. You led him there. You opened the way. You let him ambush us. How are you not already ranged against us?
An ugly look crossed Melion's face.
You may have heard us speaking, little Nephilim, he said. But if we kill you before you return to the Clave to tell your tales, none others need ever know. The knight started forward. Alec let an arrow fly and it plunged into Melion's leg. The knight toppled backward with a cry.
Alex strode forward, already notching another arrow to his bow. Melion was on the ground, moaning, the snow around him turning red. Alex stood over him, bow at the ready.
"Tell us how to get Magnus, how to get the prisoners back," he said. "Do it, or I'll turn you into a pincushion."
Melion spat. His white armor seemed to blend into the snow around him.
"I will tell you nothing," he said. "Torture me, kill me, I shall not betray my queen."
"It doesn't matter what he says anyway," said Isabel. "He can lie, remember?"
Alex's face shut.
"True," he said.
"Die then, liar,"
and he let the next arrow go. It sank into Melion's chest and the fairy knight fell back, the force of the arrow sending his body skidding back across the snow. His head hit the cave wall with a wet smack. The queen cried out. The sound pierced Clary's ears, snapping her out of her shock. She could hear the sound of fairies shouting, running feet in the corridors outside.
"Simon," she yelled and he whirled around, "come here."
She jabbed Hyosphorus back into her belt, seized her steely and darted toward the main door, now denuded of its ragged curtain of thorns. Simon was at her heels.
"Lift me," she panted, and without asking he put his hands around her waist and thrust her upward, his vampire strength nearly sending her hurtling to the roof.
She grabbed on tight to the top of the archway with her free hand and looked down. Simon was staring up at her, obviously puzzled, but his grip on her was steady.
"Hold on," she said, and began to draw.
It was the opposite of the rune she'd drawn on Valentine's boat. This was a rune for shutting and locking, for closing away all things, for hiding and safety. Black lines spread from the tip of her steely as she drew, and she heard Simon say, "Hurry up, they're coming," just as she finished and drew the steely back. The ground underneath them jerked. They fell together, Clary landing on Simon. Not the most comfortable landing, he was all knees and elbows, and rolling to the side as a wall of earth began to slide across the open archway like a theater curtain being drawn. There were shadows rushing toward the door, shadows that began to take the shape of running fairy folk, and Simon jerked Clary upright just as the doorway that opened onto the corridor disappeared with a final rumble, shutting away the fairies on the other side.
"By the angel," Isabel said in an awed voice.
Clary turned around, steely in hand. Jace was on his feet, the steely queen in front of him, his sword pointed at her heart. Alex stood over Melion's corpse. He was expressionless as he looked at Clary, and then at his parabatai. Behind him opened the passageway through which Melion had come and Gwyn had gone.
"Are you going to close the back tunnel?"
Simon asked Clary. She shook her head.
"Meliorn had pitch on his shoes," she said.
"And the streams of Edom shall be turned into pitch, remember? I think he came from the demon realms. I think they're that way."
"Jace," Alex said, "tell the queen what we want and that if she does it, we will let her live."
The queen laughed, a shrill sound.
"Little archer boy," she said, "I underestimated you. Sharp are the arrows of a broken heart."
Alex's face tightened. "You underestimated all of us, you always have. You and your arrogance. The fair folk are an old people, a good people. You aren't fit to lead them. Under your rule, they will all wind up like this," he said, jerking his chin towards Melion's corpse.
"You are the one who killed him," said the queen, "not I."
"Everyone pays," Alex said, and his eyes on her were steady and blue and hard.
"We desire the safe return of the hostages Sebastian Morgenstern has taken," said Jace.
The queen spread her hands.
"They are not in this world, nor here in Faerie, nor in any land over which I have jurisdiction. There is nothing I can do to help you rescue them, nothing at all."
"Very well," said Jace, and Clary had the feeling he had expected that response.
"There is one thing you can do, one thing you can show us that will make me spare you."
The queen went still.
"What is that, Shadowhunter?"
"The road to the demon realm of Edom," said Jace. "We want safe passage to it. We will walk it and walk our way out of your kingdom."
To Clary's surprise, the queen seemed to relax. The tension bled from her posture and a small smile tugged at the corner of her mouth, a smile that Clary did not like. "Very well. I will lead you to the road to the demon realm."
The queen lifted her diaphanous dress in her hand so that she could make her way down the steps that surrounded her divan. Her feet were bare and as white as the snow.
she began to make her way across the room to the dark passage that stretched away behind her throne. Alec fell into step behind Jace, and Isabel behind him. Clary and Simon made up the rear, a strange procession.
"I really, really hate to say this," Simon said in a low voice as they went out from the throne room and into the shadowed darkness of the underground passage. "But that kind of seemed too easy."
"That wasn't easy," Clary whispered back.
"I know, but the Queen, she's clever. She could have found a way out of doing this if she wanted to. She doesn't have to let us go to the demon realms."
"But she does want to," Clary said. "She thinks we'll die there." Simon shot her a sideways look.
"Will we?"
"I don't know," Clary said, and sped up her pace to catch up with the others. The corridor wasn't as long as Clary had thought. Its darkness had made the distance seem impossible, but they had only been walking for a half hour or so when they broke out from the shadows and into a larger, lighted space. They had been walking in silence and darkness, Clary lost in her thoughts, memories of the house she and Sebastian had shared, the sound of the wild hunt roaring across the sky, of that piece of paper with the words, "My beautiful one," on it. That hadn't been romance, that had been respect. The Seely Queen, the beautiful one.
"The Queen likes to be on the winning side of things, Clary, and that side will be ours," Sebastian had said to her once. Even when she had reported that to the Clave, she had taken it as part of his bluster. She had believed, along with the Council, that the fair folks' word that they were loyal was enough, that the Queen would at least wait to see which way the wind blew before she broke any alliances. She thought of the catch in Jace's breath when he'd said a betrayal long planned. Maybe none of them had considered it because they hadn't been able to bear considering it, that the Queen would be so sure of Sebastian's eventual victory that she would hide him in Faerie, where he could not be tracked, that she would help him in battle. Clary thought of the earth opening in the Adamant Citadel and taking Sebastian and the Indarkin down into it. That had been Faerie magic. The courts lay underground, after all. Why else had the Dark Shadow Hunters who had attacked the Los Angeles Institute taken Mark Blackthorn? Everyone had assumed Sebastian was afraid of the vengeance of the fair folk, but he wasn't. He was in league with them. He had taken Mark because he had fairy blood, and because of that blood, they thought Mark belonged to them. In all her life, she had never thought so much as she had in the past 6 months about blood and what it meant. Nephilim blood bred true. She was a shadow hunter. Angel blood, it made her what she was, gifted her with the power of runes. It made Jace what he was, made him strong and fast and brilliant. Morgenstern blood, she had it, and so did Sebastian, and that was why he cared about her at all. It gave her a dark heart, too. Or did it? Was it Sebastian's blood, Morgenstern and demon mix, that made him a monster? Or could he have been changed, fixed, made better, taught otherwise, as the Lightwoods had taught Jace?
"Here we are," said the Seely Queen, and her voice was amused. "Can you guess the right road?"
They stood in a massive cave, the roof lost in shadow. The walls glowed with a phosphorescent shine, and four roads branched off from where they stood, the one behind them and three others. One was clear and broad and smooth, leading directly ahead of them. The one on the left shone with green leaves and bright flowers, and Clary thought she saw the glimmer of blue sky in the distance. Her heart longed to go that way. And the last way, the darkest, was a narrow tunnel, the entrance wound about with spiked metal and thorn bushes lining the sides. Clary thought she could see darkness and stars at the end. Alec laughed shortly.
"We're shadow hunters," he said. "We know the old tales. This is the three roads."
At Clary's puzzled look, he said, "Fairies don't like their secrets to get out, but sometimes human musicians have been able to encode fairy secrets into ancient ballads. There's one called Thomas the Rhymer, about a man who was kidnapped by the Queen of Faerie."
"Hardly kidnapped," objected the Queen. "He came quite willingly."
"And she took him to a place where three roads lay and told him that one went to heaven, and one went to Fairyland, and one went to hell. And see ye not that narrow road, so thick beset with thorns and briars? That is the path of righteousness, though after it but few inquires." Alec pointed toward the narrow tunnel.
"It goes to the mundane world," said the Queen sweetly. "Your folk find it heavenly enough there."
That's how Sebastian got to the Adamant Citadel and had warriors backing him up that the Clave couldn't see, said Jace in disgust. He used this tunnel. He had warriors hanging back here in Faerie where they couldn't be tracked. They came through when he needed them. He gave the Queen a dark look. Many Nephilim are dead because of you.
Mortals, said the Queen. They die.
Alec ignored her.
There, he said, pointing to the leafy tunnel. That goes farther into Faerie. And that, he pointed ahead, is the road to Hell. That's where we're going.
I always heard it was paved with good intentions, said Simon.
Place your feet upon the way and find out, Daylighter, said the Queen.
Jace twisted the tip of the blade in her back. What will stop you from telling Sebastian we've come after him the moment we leave you? The Queen made no noise of pain, only her lips thinned. She looked old in that moment, despite the youth and beauty of her face.
You ask a fine question, and even if you kill me, there are those in my court who will speak to him of you, and he will guess your intentions, for he is clever. You cannot evade his knowing, save you kill all the fair folk in my court.
Jace paused. He held the seraph blade in his hand, the tip pressed up against the Seely Queen's back. Its light flared up onto his face, carving out its beauty in peaks and valleys, the sharpness of cheekbones and the angle of jaw. It caught the tips of his hair and licked them with fire, as if he were wearing a crown of burning thorns. Clary watched him, and others did as well, silently, giving him their trust. Whatever decision he made, they would stand behind it.
Come now, said the Queen. You do not have the stomach for so much killing. You were always Valentine's gentlest child.
Her eyes lingered a moment on Clary, gleeful. You have a dark heart in you, Valentine's daughter. Swear, said Jace. I know what promises mean to your people. I know you cannot lie. Swear you will say nothing of us to Sebastian, nor will you allow anyone in your court to do the same.
I swear, said the Queen. I swear that no one in my court, by word or deed, will tell him that you came here.
Jace stepped away from the Queen, lowering his blade to his side. I know you think you are sending us to our deaths, he said, but we will not die so easily. We will not lose this war, and when we are victorious, we shall make you and your people bleed for what you have done.
The Queen's smile left her face.
They turned away from her and started down the path to Edom, silently. Clary looked over her shoulder once as they went, and saw only the outline of the Queen, motionless, watching them go, her eyes burning. The corridor curved far away into the distance, seeming as if it had been hollowed out of the rock around it by fire. As the five of them went forward, moving in total silence, the pale stone walls around them darkened, stained here and there by streaks of charcoal blackness, as if the rock itself had burned. The smooth floor began to give way to a rockier one, grit crunching under their boot heels. The phosphorescence in the walls started to dim, and Alec drew his witchlight from his pocket and raised it overhead. As the light rayed out from between his fingers, Clary felt Simon beside her stiffen.
What is it? She whispered.
Something's moving. He jabbed a finger in the direction of the shadows ahead. Up there. Clary squinted but saw nothing. Simon's vampire eyesight was better even than a shadow hunter's. As quietly as she could, she drew his forest from her belt and paced a few steps ahead, keeping to the shadows at the sides of the tunnel. Jace and Alec were deep in conversation. Clary tapped Izzy on the shoulder and whispered to her.
There's someone here, or something.
Isabel didn't reply, only turned to her brother and made a gesture at him, a complicated movement of fingers. Alec's eyes showed his comprehension, and he turned immediately to Jace. Clary remembered the first time she'd seen the three of them, in pandemonium, years of practice melding them into a unit that thought together, moved together, breathed together, fought together. She couldn't help but wonder if, no matter what happened, no matter how dedicated a shadow hunter she became, she would always be on the fringes. Alec swung his hand down suddenly, dousing the light. A flash and a spark, and Isabel was gone from Clary's side. Clary spun around, holding his forest, and heard the sound of a scuffle, a thump, and then a very human yelp of pain. Stop! Simon called, and light exploded all around them.
It was as if a camera flash had gone off.
It took a moment for her eyes to adjust to the new brightness. The scene filled in slowly. Jace holding his witchlight, the glow radiating around him like the light of a small sun. Alec, his bow raised and notched. Isabel, the handle of her whip tight in one hand, the whip itself curled around the ankles of a slight figure hunched against the cave wall. A boy, with pale blonde hair that curled over his slightly pointed ears.
"Oh my God," Clary whispered, shoving her weapon back into her belt and pressing forward. "Isabel, stop, it's all right," she said, moving toward the boy. His clothes were torn and dirty, his feet bare and black with filth. His arms were bare too, and on them were the marks of runes. Shadowhunter runes.
"By the angel!" Izzy's whip slithered back into her grasp. Alec's bow fell to his side. The boy lifted his head and scowled.
"You're a shadowhunter," said Jason in an incredulous tone. The boy scowled again, more ferociously. There was anger in his look, but more than that, there was grief and fear. There was no doubting who he was. He had the same fine features as his sister, the same angled chin and hair like bleached wheat curling at the tips. He was about 16, Clary remembered. He looked younger.
"It's Mark Blackthorne," Clary said. "Helen's brother, look at his face, look at his hand."
For a moment, Mark looked confused. Clary touched her own ring finger and his eyes lit with comprehension. He held out his thin right hand. On the fourth finger, the family ring of the Blackthorns, with its design of intertwined thorns, glittered.
"How did you get here?" Jace said. "How did you know how to find us?"
"I was with the hunters underground," Mark said in a low voice. "I heard Gwyn talking to some of the others about how you'd shown up in the Queen's chamber. I sneaked away from the hunters. They weren't paying attention to me. I was looking for you and I ended up here." He gestured to the tunnel around them. "I had to talk to you. I had to know about my family."
His face was in shadow, but Clary saw his features tighten.
"The fairies told me they were all dead. Is it true?"
There was a shocked silence, and Clary read the panic in Mark's expression as his eyes darted from Isabel's downcast eyes to Jace's blank expression to Alec's tight posture.
"It's true," Mark said then. "Isn't it? My family. Your father was turned, but your brothers and sisters are alive," Clary said. "They're in Idris. They escaped. They're fine." If she had expected Mark to look relieved, she was disappointed. He went white.
"What?"
"Julian, Helen, the others, they're all alive."
Clary put her hand on his shoulder. He flinched away.
"They're alive and they're worried about you."
"Clary," Jace said, a warning in his voice. Clary shot a look over at him. Surely telling Mark his siblings were alive was the most important thing. "Have you eaten anything, drunk anything since the fair folk took you?" Jace asked, moving to peer into Mark's face. Mark jerked away, but not before Clary heard Jace's sharp intake of breath.
"What is it?" Isabel demanded.
"His eyes," Jace said, raising his witchlight and shining it into Mark's face. Mark scowled again, but allowed Jace to examine him. His eyes were large, long-lashed like Helen's. Unlike hers, his were mismatched. One was blackthorn blue, the color of water. The other was gold, hazed through with shadows, a darker version of Jace's own. Jace swallowed visibly.
"The Wild Hunt," he said. "You're one of them now."
Jace was scanning the boy with his eyes, as if Mark were a book he could read.
"Put your hands out," Jace said finally, and Mark did so.
Jace caught them and turned them over, baring the other boy's wrists. Clary felt her throat tighten. Mark was wearing only a t-shirt, and his bare forearms were striped with bloody whip marks. Clary thought of the way she had touched Mark's shoulder and he'd flinched away. God knew what his other injuries were under his clothes.
"When did this happen?"
Mark pulled his hands away. They were shaking.
"Meliorn did it," he said. "When he first took me, he said he'd stop if I ate and drank their food, so I did. I didn't think it mattered if my family was dead, and I thought fairies couldn't lie."
"Meliorn can," said Alec grimly. "Or at least he could."
"When did all this happen?" Isabel demanded.
"The fairies only took you less than a week ago." Mark shook his head.
"I've been with the folk for a long time," he said. "I couldn't say how long."
"Time runs differently in fairy," Alec said.
sometimes faster, sometimes slower. Mark said, Gwyn told me I belonged to the Hunt and I couldn't leave them unless they allowed me to go, is that true?
It's true, Jace said.
Mark slumped against the cave wall. He turned his head toward Clary.
You saw them. You saw my brothers and sisters. And Emma?
They're all right, all of them, Emma too, Clary said. She wondered if it helped. He had sworn to stay in Faerie because he thought his family was dead, and the promise held, though it was based on a lie. Was it better to think you had lost everything and to start over? Or easier to know that the people you loved were alive, even if you could never see them again? She thought of her own mother, somewhere in the world beyond the end of the tunnel. Better to know they were alive, she thought. Better for her mother and Luke to be alive and all right and for her to never see them again, than for them to be dead. Helen can't take care of them, not alone, Mark said a little desperately. And Jules, he's too young, he can't take care of Ty, he doesn't know the things he needs, he doesn't know how to talk to him. He took a shuddering breath. You should let me come with you.
You know you can't, Jay said, though he couldn't look Mark in the face, he was staring at the ground. If you've sworn fealty to the Wild Hunt, you're one of them.
Take me with you, Mark repeated. He had the stunned, bewildered look of someone who had been mortally injured but didn't yet realize the extent of the injury.
I don't want to be one of them. I want to be with my family.
We're going to hell, Clary said. We couldn't bring you with us, even if you could leave Faerie safely.
And you can't, Alex said. If you try to leave, you'll die.
I'd rather die, Mark said, and Jace's head whipped up. His eyes were bright gold, almost too bright, as if the fire inside him was spilling out through them.
They took you because you have fairy blood, but also because you have Shadowhunter blood. They want to punish the Nephilim, Jace said, his gaze intent. Show them what a Shadowhunter is made of. Show them you aren't afraid. You can live through this.
In the wavering illumination of the witchlight, Mark looked at Jace. Tears had made their tracks through the dirt on his face, but his eyes were dry.
I don't know what to do, he said. What do I do?
Find a way to warn the Nephilim, Jay said. We're going into hell, like Clary said. We might never come back. Someone has to tell the Shadowhunters the Fair Folk are not their allies.
The Hunters will catch me if I try to send a message.
The boy's eyes flashed. They'll kill me.
Not if you're fast and smart, said Jace. You can do it, I know you can.
Jace, Alex said, his bow at his side. Jace, we need to let him go before the Hunt notice he's missing.
Right, Jace said and hesitated.
Clary saw him take Mark's hand. He pressed his witchlight into the boy's palm where it flickered and then resumed its steady glow.
Take this with you, said Jace, for it can be dark in the land under the hill and the years very long.
Mark stood for a moment, the runestone in his hand. He looked so slight in the wavering light that Clary's heart hammered a tattoo of disbelief. Surely they could help him. They were Nephilim. They didn't leave their own behind. And then he turned and ran, away from them, on soundless bare feet.
Mark, Clary whispered and cut herself off.
He was gone. The shadow swallowed him up, only the darting will-o'-the-wisp light of the runestone visible, until it too blended with the darkness. She looked up at Jace.
What did you mean, the land under the hill? She asked. Why did you say that?
Jace didn't answer. He looked stunned. She wondered if Mark, brittle and orphaned and alone, reminded him somehow of himself.
The land under the hill is fairy, said Alec.
An old, old name for it. He'll be all right, he said to Jace.
He will.
You gave him your witchlight, Isabel said. You've always had that witchlight.
Screw the witchlight, Jay said violently and slammed his hand against the wall of the cave.
There was a brief flare of light and he drew his arm back. The mark of his hand was burned into the stone of the tunnel, and his palm still glowed as if the blood in his fingers were phosphorus. He gave an odd, choked laugh.
I don't exactly need it anyway.
Jace, Clary said and put her arm on his arm. He didn't move away from her, but he didn't react either. She dropped her voice.
You can't save everyone, she said.
Maybe not, he said as the light in his hand dimmed. But it would be nice to save someone for a change.
Guys, Simon said.
He had been oddly quiet throughout the encounter with Mark, and Clary was startled to hear him speak now.
I don't know if you can see it, but there's something, something at the end of the tunnel.
A light? Jace said, his voice edged with sarcasm. His eyes glittered.
The opposite.
Simon moved forward, and after a hesitant moment, Clary took her hand from Jace's arm and followed him. The tunnel went straight on ahead and then jogged slightly. At the curve, she saw what Simon must have seen and stopped dead. Darkness. The tunnel ended in a whirling vortex of darkness. Something moved in it, shaping the dark like the wind shaping clouds. She could hear it too. The purr and rumble of the dark like the sound of jet engines. The others joined her. Together they stood in a line watching the dark, watching it move. A curtain of shadow and beyond it the utter unknown. It was Alec who spoke, staring, awed at the moving shadows. The air that blew down the corridor was stinging hot, like pepper thrown into the heart of a fire.
This, he said, is the craziest thing we've ever done.
What if we can't ever come back? Isabel said. The ruby around her neck was pulsing, glowing like a stoplight, illuminating her face.
Then at least we'll be together, Clary said, and looked around at her companions.
She reached out and took Jace's hand and Simon's hand on the other side of her, and held them tight.
We go through together, and on the other side we stay together, she said. All right?
None of them answered, but Isabel took Simon's other hand and Alec took Jace's. They all stood for a moment, staring. Clary felt Jace's hand tighten on hers, a nearly imperceptible pressure. They stepped forward, and the shadows swallowed them up.
Mirror, my mirror, said the queen, placing her hand upon the mirror. Show me my morning star. The mirror hung on the wall of the queen's bedroom. It was surrounded by wreaths of flowers, roses from which no one had cut away the thorns. The mist inside the mirror coalesced, and Sebastian's angular face looked out. My beautiful one, he said. His voice was calm and composed, though there was blood on his face and clothes. He was holding his sword, and the stars along the blade were dimmed with scarlet. I am somewhat occupied at the moment. I thought you might wish to know that your sister and adoptive brother have just left this place, said the queen. They found the road to Edom. They are coming to you. His face transformed with a wolfish grin. And they didn't make you promise not to tell me that they came to your court. They did, said the queen. They said nothing about telling you of leaving. Sebastian laughed. They killed one of my knights, said the queen. Spilled blood before my throne. They are beyond my reach now. You know my people cannot survive in the Poisoned Lands. You will have to take my revenge for me. The light in his eyes changed. The queen had always found what Sebastian felt for his sister, and Jace as well, to be something of a mystery. But then Sebastian himself was by far the greater mystery. Before he had come to make her his offer, she would have never considered a true alliance with Shadowhunters. Their peculiar sense of honor made them untrustworthy. It was Sebastian's very lack of honor that made her trust him. The fine craft of betrayal was second nature to fair folk, and Sebastian was an artist of lies. I will serve your interests in all ways, my queen, he said. In a short enough while, your people and mine shall hold the reins of the world. And when we do, you may have revenge on any who have ever offended you. She smiled at him. Blood still stained the snow in her throne room, and she still felt the jab of Jace Lightwood's blade against her throat. It was not a real smile, but she knew enough to let her beauty do her work for her sometimes. I do adore you, she said. Yes, said Sebastian. And his eyes flickered, their color like dark clouds. The queen wondered idly if he thought of the two of them the way she did, lovers who, even while embracing, each held a knife to the other's back, ready to stab and to betray. And I do like to be adored, he grinned. I am glad they are coming. Let them come. Part 2. That World. Inverted. And that the whole land thereof is brimstone, and salt, and burning. That it is not sown, nor beareth, nor any grass groweth therein. Deuteronomy 29:23.
14. The Sleep of Reason. Clary stood on a shady lawn that rolled away down a sloping hill. The sky overhead was perfectly blue, dotted here and there with white clouds. At her feet, a stone walkway stretched to the front door of a large manor house, built of mellow golden stone. She craned her head back, looking up. The house was lovely. The stones were the color of butter in the spring sunshine, covered in trellises of climbing roses in red and gold and orange. Wrought iron balconies curved out from the facade, and there were two large arch doors of bronze-colored wood, their surfaces wrought with delicate designs of wings. "Wings for the Fairchilds," said a soft voice reassuring in the back of her mind. "This is Fairchild Manor. It has stood for 400 years and will stand 400 more." "Clary!" Her mother appeared at one of the balconies, wearing an elegant champagne-colored dress. Her red hair was down, and she looked young and beautiful. Her arms were bare, circled with black runes. "What do you think? Doesn't it look gorgeous?" Clary followed her mother's gaze toward where the lawn flattened out. There was an archway of roses set up at the end of an aisle, on either side of which were rows of wooden benches. White flowers were scattered along the aisle, the white flowers that grew only in Idris. The air was rich with their honey scent. She looked back up at her mother, who was no longer standing alone on the balcony. Luke was standing behind her, an arm around her waist. He was in rolled-up shirt sleeves and formal trousers, as if halfway dressed for a party. His arms, too, were twined with runes, runes for good luck, for insight, for strength, for love. "Are you ready?" he called down to Clary. "Ready for what?" she said, but they didn't seem to hear her. Smiling, they disappeared back into the house. Clary took a few steps along the path. "Clary!" She whirled. He was coming toward her across the grass, slender, with white pale hair that shone in the sunlight, dressed in formal black with gold runes at his collar and cuffs. He was grinning, a smudge of dirt on his cheek, and holding up a hand to block the brightness of the sun. "Sebastian." He was entirely the same, and yet entirely different. He was clearly himself, and yet the whole shape and set of his features seemed to have changed, his bones less sharp, his skin sun-darkened rather than pale, and his eyes. His eyes shone as green as spring grass. "He has always had green eyes," said the voice in her head. "People often marvel at how much alike you are, he and your mother and yourself. His name is Jonathan, and he is your brother. He has always protected you." "Clary," he said again, "you're not going to believe."
"Jonathan!"
A small voice trilled, and Clary turned her wondering eyes to see a little girl dashing across the grass. She had red hair, the same shade as Clary's, and it flew out behind her like a banner. She was barefoot, wearing a green lace dress that had been so thoroughly torn to ribbons at the cuffs and hem that it resembled shredded lettuce. She might have been 4 or 5 years old. Dirty face and adorable. As she reached Jonathan, she held up her arms and he bent down to swing her up into the air. She shrieked in delight as he held her over his head.
"Ouch, ouch, quit that, you demon child," he said as she pulled at his hair. "Val, I said stop or I'll hold you upside down, I mean it."
"Val?" Clary echoed. "But of course her name is Valentina," said the whispering voice in the back of her head. Valentine Morgenstern was a great hero of the war. He died in battle against Hodge Starkweather, but not before he had saved the mortal cup and the clave along with it. When Luke married your mother, they honored his memory in the name of their daughter.
"Clary, make him let me go, make him— Ow!"
shrieked Val as Jonathan turned her upside down and swung her through the air. Val dissolved into giggles as he set her down on the grass, and she turned a pair of eyes the exact blue of Luke's up at Clary.
"Your dress is pretty," she said matter-of-factly.
"Thank you," Clary said, still half in a daze, and looked at Jonathan, who was grinning down at his small sister. "Is that dirt on your face?" Jonathan reached up and touched his cheek. "Chocolate," he said.
You'll never guess what I found Val doing. She had both fists in the wedding cake. I'm going to have to patch it up. He squinted at Clary. Okay, maybe I shouldn't have mentioned that. You look like you're going to pass out.
I'm fine, Clary said, tugging nervously at a lock of her hair. Jonathan put his hands up as if to ward her off.
Look, I'll perform surgery on it. No one will ever be able to tell that someone ate half the roses off.
He looked thoughtful.
I could eat the other half of the roses, just so it's even.
Yeah, said Val from her place on the grass at his feet. She was busy yanking up dandelions, their white pods blowing in the wind.
Also, Jonathan added, I hate to bring this up, but you might want to put some shoes on before the wedding.
Clary looked down at herself. He was right, she was barefoot. Barefoot and wearing a pale gold dress. The hem drifted around her ankles like a sunset-colored cloud.
What wedding? Her brother's green eyes widened. Your wedding? You know, to Jace Herondale? About yay high, blonde, all the girls love him. He broke off. You having cold feet, is that what it is?
He leaned in conspiratorially.
Because if it is, I'll totally smuggle you over the border into France, and I won't tell anyone where you went, even if they stick bamboo shoots under my fingernails.
Clary stared at him.
Bamboo shoots? He shrugged eloquently. For my only sister, not counting the creature currently sitting on my foot, Val yelped, I would do it. Even if it means not getting to see Isabel Lightwood in a strapless dress.
Isabel? You like Isabel?
Clary felt as if she were running a marathon and couldn't quite catch her breath. He squinted at her. Is that a problem? Is she a wanted criminal or something? He looked thoughtful. That would be kind of hot, actually.
Okay, I don't need to know what you think is hot, Clary said automatically. Blech.
Jonathan grinned. It was an unconcerned, happy grin. The grin of someone who'd never really had much to worry about beyond pretty girls and whether one of his little sisters had eaten the other sister's wedding cake. Somewhere in the back of Clary's mind, she saw black eyes and whip marks. But she didn't know why.
He's your brother. He's your brother and he's always taking care of you.
Right, he said. Like I didn't have to suffer through years of,
ooh, Jace is so cute, do you think he likes me?
Clary said and broke off, feeling a little dizzy.
I just don't remember him proposing.
Jonathan knelt down and tugged on Val's hair. She was humming to herself, bundling daisies together in a pile.
Clary blinked, she'd been so sure they were dandelions.
Oh, I don't know if he ever did, he said casually. We all just knew you'd end up together, it was inevitable.
But I should have gotten to choose, she said in a near whisper. I should have gotten to say yes.
Well, you would have, wouldn't you? He said, watching the daisies blow across the grass.
Speaking of, do you think Isabel would go out with me if I asked her?
Clary's breath caught.
But what about Simon?
He looked up at her, the sun bright in his eyes. Who's Simon? Clary felt the ground give way under her. She reached out as if to catch at her brother, but her hand went through him. He was as insubstantial as air. The green lawn and the golden mansion and the boy and the girl on the grass flew away from her, and she stumbled, hitting the ground hard, jarring her elbows with a pain she felt flare up her arms. She rolled to her side, choking. She was lying on a patch of bleak ground. Broken cobblestones jutted up through the earth, and the burned-out shells of stone houses loomed over her. The sky was white-gray steel, shot through with black clouds like vampire veins. It was a dead world. A world with all the color leached out of it, and all the life. Clary curled up on the ground, seeing in front of her not the shell of a destroyed town, but the eyes of the brother and sister that she would never have.
Simon stood at the window, taking in the view of the city of Manhattan. It was an impressive sight. From the penthouse floor of the Carolina, you could see across Central Park to the Met Museum, to the high-rises of downtown. Night was falling, and the city lights were beginning to shine out, one by one, a bed of electric flowers. Electric flowers. He looked around, frowning thoughtfully. It was a nice turn of phrase. Perhaps he should write it down. He never seemed to have time these days to really work on lyrics. Time was swallowed up by other things. Promotion, touring, signings, appearances. It was hard to remember sometimes that his main job was making music. Still, a good problem to have. The darkening sky turned the window to a mirror. Simon smiled at his reflection in the glass. Tousled hair, jeans, vintage t-shirt. He could see the room behind him, vast acres of hardwood floor, gleaming steel, and leather furniture. A single elegant gold-framed painting on the wall. A Chagall, Clary's favorite. All soft roses and blues and greens, incongruous against the apartment's modernity. There was a vase of hydrangeas on the kitchen island, a gift from his mother, congratulating him on playing a gig with Stepping Razor the week before. "I love you," said the note attached. "I'm proud of you." He blinked at it. Hydrangeas. That was odd. If he had a favorite flower, it was roses, and his mother knew that. He turned away from the window and looked more closely at the vase. They were roses. He shook his head to clear it. White roses. They always had been. Right. He heard the rattle of keys, and the door swung open, admitting a petite girl with long red hair and a brilliant smile. "Oh my God," said Clary, half laughing, half out of breath. She pushed the door shut behind her and leaned against it. "The lobby is a zoo. Press, photographers, it's going to be crazy going out tonight." She came across the room, dropping her keys on the table. She was wearing a long dress, yellow silk printed with colorful butterflies.